People assume that time is a strict progression of cause to effect, but actually, from a non-linear, non-subjective viewpoint, it's more like a big ball of wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey.
From days of long ago, from uncharted regions of the universe, comes a legend.
Tell me, Doctor, where are we going next time? Is this the 50s or 1999?
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's time. The Fandom Podcast Network proudly presents the Fandom Flashback.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious.
Welcome to the Fandom Podcast Network's special presentation of Fandom Flashback 1986, The Movies, 30 Years Later. In this special edition of the Fandom Flashback, we will cover the year in movies for 1986. Could this possibly be the best year in movies? We will debate this throughout this four-part special. Welcome to part three of the Fandom Flashback 1986, The Movies. In this episode, we will cover the movies released in the months of July, August, and September of 1986. I'm Kevin, I'm one of your hosts, but I'd like to introduce my co-host for this time travel journey back to 1986, starting with Aaron Gill. How are you?
Hi, Kevin. Thank you for having me back on the show. It's great to be back.
In case listeners can't tell, where are you calling from?
I'm coming from down under, down in Australia, mate. Down there.
And where exactly?
Other side of the world. I'm actually in the future.
That's right. We're recording this show on November 3rd, which is a Thursday for us, but it's Friday for you.
Yeah. So scary enough, I might know your election before you guys do.
Oh, gosh. That's a good thing. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We've been really excited about this. And just to kind of tease the listeners, there's a special reason why Aaron is on this particular episode of the Fandom Flashback. And we will get more into that later. But I have another special guest and fellow member of the Fandom Podcast Network friend, and also hosts of the upcoming Couch Potato Theaters, did an awesome job with Last Starfighter with Norman. My friend and yours, Mr. Davis Grayson, how are you?
Hello, sir. How are you tonight?
I'm doing really good, man. You excited?
I am very excited. Thank you for letting me be on here tonight.
Well, I appreciate it, man. Now, one thing that we should let the listeners know, and Davis, I don't know if you know this or not, but even though Aaron is in the future for us, tomorrow for her is her birthday.
Wow.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, we're going to have to find out if she's actually qualified to be on this show, because you have to be a certain vintage to participate in the show. So let's actually talk about that right now. Aaron, how old were you in 1986?
I think I might, for out of this lot so far, I think I might be the oldest. So in 1986, I was 16.
So you're the elder and wise one.
Yeah, I'm like a vintage, you know.
You're probably that girl that we all kind of looked up to. You were like the cool kid, and you know, you were a year older. You had a year of experience, and then you were also probably the one to get us into trouble then, right?
Yeah, yes. I have to say that 16 was a good year. It was definitely the year of experience. Leave it at that.
Okay, now, Davis, we got to make sure that you can participate in this special episode. How old were you in 1986?
Well, since we are actually covering from in the summertime, I was actually 11, just turned 11.
Okay, that you are allowed to be on this show. That qualifies.
I just made the cut.
You're in the PG section.
Yes, and I was somewhere right there in the middle. I was, I think I was 15, going on 16, I think, something like that. Yeah. So, very impressionable decade for us, and especially this year. First of all, thank you guys for joining me for this special episode of Fandom Flashback. But we want to have the listeners kind of feel like they're in 1986. Want to kind of set the stage, let them know what else was happening other than these awesome movies that are all turning 30 this year. Let's take a step back to 1986. Let's fuel up that DeLorean with the flux capacitor. Let's slingshot around the sun aboard a captured Klingon bird of prey. And take a step into that blue police box that was larger on the inside as we travel back to 1986 and remind us what was happening in pop culture, sports, and politics in the middle of this decade of decadence. Now, as I mentioned before in the previous two episodes, Ronald Reagan was the president, and the big political thing was USSR armed talks between Reagan and Gorbachev, which was slowly easing us out of the Cold War. Of course, Reagan got into trouble with his administration with the whole Iran-Contra affair. Aaron, I want to turn to you real quick. Was there anything politically in Australia that was happening big during 86?
Oh, probably, but the age of 16, that wasn't in my universe.
That's fine. So, that's fine. You know, I didn't know if there was anything particular, because we, you know, when it came to this stuff that was on, we saw it on Time Magazine, which is a big publication here, and we saw it all over. So I didn't know if there was anything politically, but I know there's other stuff that was going on. We'll touch on that. Well, let me ask you this. Do you know, now a gallon of gas for us was about 89 cents, but you guys go by liter down there, right?
Yeah. So I should have looked this up, actually. I think, there it would have probably been about, what was it, $1.80 a liter. Where are we now? We're about a dollar. So, yeah, probably even less than that. But, yeah.
Well, in comparison, how much is a gallon or is a liter of gas there now?
A liter of gas now, when I filled up today, was, well, because it's dropped. It's been good, actually. I think about $1.15.
Okay. All right, yeah. Cool. Let me ask you, Davis, how much is a gallon of gas now down where you are?
It ranges between about 207 in some parts to about 225, something like that.
And where are you exactly in Florida?
Central Florida area, just below the House of the Mouse.
Okay, that's right, a little kind of South Orlando area. Gotcha, okay. Did anything recently spike with stuff that was happening, you know, elsewhere? Because we had a little spike in our prices because of refineries in Alabama blowing up or something. I couldn't remember. But whenever they get an opportunity to raise gas around here, they do. So,
no, nothing on my end. I didn't see anything happen.
Okay. In sports, the Chicago Bears defeated New England Patriots to win the Super Bowl. The Giants would then go on to win the Super Bowl in 87. To beat the Denver Broncos. Boston Celtics won their championship. Mets defeated the Boston Red Sox in 7 to win their World Series. I want to touch with sports with you real quick, Aaron. What you know? I know you guys got some different sports down there. What was going on down there?
Not really looking up on the old Wikipedia. I mean, the main thing is Aussie football, or as we like to call it, football. So that year it was Hawthorn defeats Carlton, which will mean nothing to you. But it was Hawthorn's one of the big players. It seems to always be in the finals. So Carlton, not so much these days. But that's who won for the 90th VFL Premiership. So, and they
Okay, well, let me ask you this. You said you guys call it football, but I was informed by our friend Adam that they call it footy now.
Yeah, it is. Well, because they call soccer football. So people who do that half and half, so you'll go, we call it soccer, they call it football. So here's footy. Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, 86 pop culture gave us many things. And as I mentioned before, swatches. Davis, did you own a swatch?
I did own a swatch. It was charcoal gray and also had a swatch guard.
Nice. Aaron, did swatches get down there in Australia? Were they popular down there?
Yes. And obviously, we're still in 1986 because I still have one. And I'm wearing it right now.
So do I. That's what I was wearing today. Only because the battery went out on my other watch, but I decided to break that out. So. Swatch guards. Now, Davis, we're going to have you on the next episode that will cover October, November, December, because we're going to talk about toys. And I know that's your specialty. But there were some things that came out, obviously, the Nintendo NES, the Omnibot 2000, the My Buddy Dolls and stuff. Briefly, though, was there a certain toy that came out there that we'll probably elaborate more on the next show that really hit home with you in this year?
None other than the Terradrome.
Are you talking G.I. Joe, buddy?
Yeah, the G.I. Joe Terradrome. So that was the year it was released.
Excuse me, the G.I. Joe / Cobra, the Enemy Terradrome.
Ah, close enough.
Aaron, about you, was there any toys or little, you know, pop culture stuff that was very popular in 86? You know, the decade of having, you know, material items?
Oh, wow. I think it was the start of having a Walkman. I think that was the sort of big thing. I don't know. At 16, we didn't have – I don't know. My brother had the – like he had all the Castle Grayskull and all that stuff, which I think he's absolutely spewing he still doesn't have now. So he had all the He-Man stuff. Right. Where did that go? It was – and I think we sort of got early – video games. Remember Pong tennis? Oh, yeah. So there was hours of entertainment of looking at two lines going duh, 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 and getting faster. So, there was squash and two people could play. So I think by then we also went up. So there was my brother was the gamer. We did have sort of like Lock and Chase, which was a very sort of pale version of Pac-Man.
Gotcha.
I remember having that, but yeah, I think by that time it was all boys.
Well, Davis, was there any other toys? Real quick, I think I may have cut you off. Was there something else you wanted to give a shout out to real quick?
Oh, no, except for 1986 was the year I learned about DNA.
DNA?
And when
the strands of life, you mean?
Yes, when I talk about that, that is the year of the four-part miniseries for G.I. Joe written by Buzz Dixon. Was Arise, Serpentor, Arise.
Oh, that was 86, wasn't it? Oh, indeed. Wow. That's right. Oh, man. Ah, thank you for mentioning that. That just made me tickle.
You're welcome.
I'm such a girl. No. Yeah.
Now, I have to ask you this, Aaron, because this was a huge charity event. We've mentioned it before in the show. Did you guys hear about our silly thing that we called Hands Across America, which did help, was brought great cause and a lot of money to the charity? Did you guys hear about this?
Oh, vaguely, because it was it after the Live Aid? I think that was 83, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Vaguely, okay. No, I'm going to say. I sort of know of it, but nah.
Okay. I have to ask because I was curious if, you know, how popular, if, you know, popular reaching across the shores it did or not. So
I didn't think it reached that far. Okay. we're pretty far.
Well, let's talk briefly about music right now, and we'll touch on that again a little bit later. But rock and roll first 10 musicians were inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 86. And we had popular artists were like Robert Palmer, Van Halen, The Police, Whitney Houston, Bruce Springsteen, Prince, Culture Club, Madonna, and of course the Bangles. Let us know what was big down there in Australia this time.
Yeah, that was a year that Whispering Jack from John Farnham, who was a singer, amazing voice. And he did a little stint in a band called the Little River Band for a bit. And then he brought out this solo album, Whispering Jack, which went on to be the biggest selling album ever. And I still think it still is. And it was also the first one to be put onto CD. Remember them?
Yeah, compact disc. Hey, I'm still rocking compact discs.
And there's just a little funny one on that is I remember listening to it on like one of the radio and they were like, this is the first time it's playing, and they played it and it got stuck. I remember that quite – and it sort of had – it got stuck and it sort of went – and I was like –
let me ask you, did you buy – was that your first CD then, or did you buy something else after
that? No, I held off. And I'm going to say – and this is going to – I'm going to say my first CD was Damn Yankees.
Nice.
Okay, as much as Ted Nugent is horrible, horrible, horrible man, and I'm like the vegan and love animals, he's a mean guitarist, but oh, I did love that Yankees album.
It had Tommy Shaw from Styx and Jack from, what was it? What was the name? Jack, the other singer in that band. Was it Sister Christian? I'm forgetting that guy's name. But that was kind of like a bunch of super groups getting together to form like, yeah, we're going to be hair metal, but we're going to be awesome musicians too.
Yeah.
Okay. So what other music was popular then?
Of course, AC/DC, big. I think a lot of people actually thought they were American, but no, they were from Melbourne, where I'm from, down in Ringwood.
Yeah, at first we had no idea, but yeah, that was with Who Made Who, right?
Yes, Who Made Who, and then Working Class Man with Jimmy Barnes, who for a lot of your listeners probably like going, huh? But if you remember in Lost Boys, there was a song with Jimmy Barnes and Michael Hutchins in it from NXS, and so that's where he was from. Also,
is that the song where it has the guy, the big muscular shirtless guy playing the sax?
No. It was just one of the songs. I think it was just playing in the background.
Okay.
Also, so NXS with Listen Like Thieves. I think they were like the biggest pop band in the world at the time.
Yeah. Oh yeah, great, amazing song too.
And also Crowded House, which New Zealand band. Again, people think they're Australian. And they had a song, Don't Dream It's Over, was seen in Smallville.
Great
remember
song.
The Stand? I actually love the series The Stand. Okay. So, yeah, so they were the big sort of ones. For me, it had to be John Mellencamp. He changed his name by then. So I think it was Scarecrow. Came out that year. I love that. Gotcha. Oh, yeah, I just showed you. Okay. I'm so middle of the road and I'm stuck in there. But
Davis, let me ask you, first of all, what was your CD? Do you remember what it was?
I think it was a country music CD. I was really big into country music during that time. And that was actually the year 1986 was the year Alabama released its greatest hits. And that was also the year Dwight Yoakam and Randy Travis actually started country. So I mean, it was a renaissance year for country music during that time, because it was the first year in like 40 years that there was a number one hit, a different number one hit every week. So
okay,
I have to say it was probably country music. I mean, that was,
but you were still rocking the cassette Walkman though, I'm sure, right?
Oh, of course. And the only way to record good music was to actually record commercials as well, so hey.
That's right. Did you record off the radio like a bunch of us did?
I did. I also listened to Fox 97. I don't know if you remember that radio station in Atlanta. They had a lot of oldies.
Okay.
That was one of my favorite ones I listened to. And a lot of my friends would just get on my case going, why do you have commercials? I was like, I got to listen to the whole song. So.
Yeah, no, that's funny. And I grew up in Southern California. We had like the Mighty 690 on AM radio. And then we had... there was a couple more in my area, but we were always recording stuff and music like that. So,
oh, also,
what was that?
3XY in Melbourne, and you'd sit there and you'd be hating the voiceover person. So stop talking over the song. Stop.
I know.
And
yes.
You know what? I still have those tapes.
Oh my God, that's
I
so funny.
I found them when I moved. I still got the cassette tapes of the compilation. Love compilations.
Oh, that's awesome. So that's awesome. By the way, I think my first CD I mentioned before was the AC/DC. I think it was the Maximum Overdrive Who Made Who album or whatever it was, because that was in 86. And that was my first CD, even though I had plenty of cassettes. And then eventually I started, I remember getting Guns N' Roses. It was 87, Appetite for Destruction and stuff. So, yeah, good time for music, listening to a lot of radio. That's how we mostly got our stuff. And, of course, getting into the Walkmans and, the big headphones. So that was always fun. Let me ask you this. In 86, Aaron, we had our Space Shuttle Challenger disaster. I wanted to ask you, because that was in January. It was traumatic for a lot of us here in the States, because the teacher, Kristen McAuliffe, was going up. So that means a lot of schools are watching this live. What kind of impact did the Challenger disaster have on you guys in Australia?
I don't think as big as you guys, because, I mean, we knew of it. We saw it. But I think, you guys want to close schools and stuff like that. It was just something that happened on TV. But it was, it was a big tragedy. But of course, you know, again, we were saying that whether or not, of course, you saw it on the time, we probably were in the middle of the night. Gotcha. So like with 9/11, you know, happened, everyone was at different times. So yeah, like my brother saw it in the middle of the night.
Yeah, you're right. I think that was probably around like between 10 at night and 1 a.m. your time the next day. So. Yeah. Okay. All right.
So, well, and whether or not people had recorders is another thing. So.
Gotcha. Davis, what about you growing up in Florida? How did that affect you? Do you remember that day well?
Well, I actually grew up in Georgia. And
oh, that's right. I'm sorry. That's right. Now you live in
Georgia. It's all good. It's all good. I actually called in sick that day. I was sick from high school, from middle school, and I had saw the Challenger lifted off, and I went back to sleep. And then when I woke up later, I did not hear about the explosion until my mom came home from work that day.
So you saw it take off, and you literally turned it off like seconds before the disaster.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I don't know why, but it is. Wow. Well, let me – do you think you would have kept watching if you saw eventually what was going to happen? Would you have not – you know, would you have watched this being homesick?
I probably would have. I just remember hearing that the shuttle was about to take off, and – it started to lift off, and I remember for some reason, I don't know why, I changed the channel or I went to sleep at that time. I did something different, and then it wasn't until about 3:30 that afternoon when my mom told me that the shuttle had exploded.
Okay, now hold on. You're sick, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, when I was sick at this time in the 80s, I was watching TV. That's when everyone watched Price is Right, man. When you were sick, you watched Price is Right and a couple other game shows, and then your parents or whoever, you know, was like, no, you got to go to bed. But yeah, Price is Right was kind of the show that everyone got to watch when they were homesick, and you know, then some people maybe started watching some soaps or whatever. But that's funny though. were sleeping because you would be in the Good Boy sick. That's what you were doing.
Oh yeah, and then you know, if Days of Our Lives came on, you had to watch that, right?
That's right.
Young for and the me, Restless.
For me, it was Santa Barbara. That's what I was watching.
Nice.
My mother still watches Young and the Restless.
Wow.
43 years later, she's still watching it.
Good for her. That is awesome. Give a shout out to your mom. How's she doing, by the way?
Yeah, she's good. She's good. Okay, yeah. Good. No, it's all good.
All right. So we also had the nuclear disaster in Chernobyl there in USSR. Did you guys, was that big news for you, Aaron, back then?
Yes, I think, yes, it was. It was of course, a big disaster, nuclear. And I think it was at the time when it was very much, you know, they had that movie The Day After.
And it
was all still, and that was a bit earlier in the 80s. But then we all watched that, and it was all like,
I live 5K out of town.
Yeah, and I'm going to be the one that looks like the guy out of RoboCop, and it was all that sort of stuff. So, help me.
What's funny is we're all laughing. So, Davis and I are laughing because we know exactly what you mean. Well, what about you, Davis? What kind of impact did that have on you?
You know, I just remember Chernobyl when it actually blew up. There was so much. I don't know, with hype, with different people saying that World War III could commence at any time. A lot of people were just saying that. I think a lot of people were saying the sky was falling with some things. I mean, it was just one of those things where you just, you know, you remember a little bit of it, but, you know, you hope to just move past it and, you know, hope for something better.
Yeah, there was a lot of that during that decade, definitely. But, hey, the reason why we're here right now is 86 gave us a great year in movies. And that's what we're here to celebrate on this special presentation, the Fandom Flashback, here on the Fandom Podcast Network. With this being the year 2016, we are celebrating the 30th anniversary of all of these 1986 films. And many of these 1986 movies became legendary with box office receipts to back it up. Some became cult classics, and some 86 movies were so bad, they were good, and well, some were just plain bad. 1986 also gave birth to many of our current classic fandoms we still celebrate today, like Highlander, Aliens, Transformers, and Robotech the movie. We will celebrate, debate, and discuss this fantastic year on this special episode of 1986. And as I mentioned before, we are talking about July, August, and September. Now, these 3 months are the big ones when it came to the amount of popular movies, cultural, you know, revolutionary, whatever you want to say. These 3 months are the big one. Of course, the last one that we talked about, probably the biggest two came out of that would be Top Gun and Ferris Bueller, to name a couple of them. Let's start with July here. Now, July is pretty packed here, especially for some of the movies here. So I'm going to cover the first half of it, and then we're going to jump into it here. So the first half of July, July 2nd, we had About Last Night, Big Trouble in Little China, Psycho 3, The Great Mouse Detective, Under the Cherry Moon, that was the Prince film, Club Paradise, Aliens, and Vamp. Aliens and Vamp came out in July of 18, but let me start with you, Aaron. Now, we know that Aliens is probably the big one for all of us, so we're going to wait for that at the end of July conversation here, so hold on to that. But other than Aliens, of these films that I've mentioned here, is there one or two of these that jump out at you that mean something special to you?
About Last Night. Because yes. Rob Lowe naked, hello. And really, is there any? There's no other argument. And Big Trouble in Little China. Now I saw both at the cinema, okay. And quite a few times each. So probably about Last Night. It was a girl. It was a very, very good relationship film, and it was based on a play which Jim Belushi actually did on stage. So it was Rob Lowe, Demi Moore, who were in St. Elmo's Fire together.
Yeah, and they were Perkins.
The Brat Pack, Elizabeth Perkins of Big, and Jim Belushi, who was the brother of James Belushi, who of course had passed away.
And Megan Mullally. And I loved it. Megan Mullally from Will and Grace was in that too.
Oh, I don't know. Yes. I haven't seen it for a long time, and I actually need to revisit it. And I think it was a great relationship film. I think if it's and I would say a girly film. It was a girly film.
You know, it's interesting. I'm glad you brought this movie up because I didn't see it until video about a year or two. No, actually, it's about 3 or 4 years later. I was working with a coworker of mine. He was an older guy, and he loved this film. And I said, you know, I didn't see that. Like you said, I thought it was kind of a chick flick. And he says, no, it's a really good film. But my only problem with the film is I hate the last few minutes of it because it's a very realistic film on people working together, breaking up, trying to get things back together. But he didn't like it because at the very end of the film, Rob Lowe and Demi Moore give a little hope that they're going to get back together, where he wished that they would have realized they've gone through the trials of their relationship and realized it's not going to work. So they had the typical Hollywood ending. There's hope at the end of it. And that's the only thing he told me. But I didn't remember watching it going, you know, this movie's pretty good. And I kind of like the little happy hope ending to it. So that's it. I'm glad you brought that movie up.
Depends if it was in the play. So it would be interesting to see if that tag was just a Hollywood tag to give that glimmer of hope. And you know, it was a very interesting thing of, you know, it was all what I call lust. I mean, they were in their 20s. You know, you're pretty insane when you're in your 20s. Everything means everything. You know, you get into your 40s and it's like, I just don't care.
And for us guys, you know, we love Demi Moore's voice. She had that kind of sexy smoker's voice, you know, so.
And then there's the two versions. There's the Demi Moore and Rob Lowe naked in the kitchen scene. And then there's the TV version where she's wearing a T-shirt.
Yeah, no, I saw the naked version.
Yeah, we all saw the naked. And weren't we happy when video came in?
Yes.
Pausing.
Oh, yeah.
Pausing.
Davis, what about you? Which some movies from August 2nd through the 18th here jump out at you?
From August 2nd to the 18th?
Yeah, About Last Night, Big Trouble, Psycho 3, Great Mouse Detective, Under the Cherry Moon, Club Paradise, Aliens, and Vamp. I mean, we're going to save for Aliens a little bit at the end of the July segment here.
You know, I'm going to go since I'm just south of the mouse, I'm going to go with Great Mouse Detective.
That's cool.
One reason it was such a good movie is just the fact that Vincent Price had just crossed off a list off his bucket list. He had always wanted to be in a Disney movie.
Really?
Yeah. And so he was able to do that. And while he was doing the voice of Radigan, how he was doing his Shakespeare motions with his hands and everything, the animators actually picked up on that and used that in the movie.
Fascinating. That is really cool. I didn't know that was a bucket list item for him. That's really cool.
Yeah, and the other cool thing about it is this is right before the Renaissance for Disney movies actually took off. So you see like the Great Mouse Detective, the Black Cauldron. So it's not quite there, but it's slowly getting there. Like there's the one scene in the clock tower. That is the first major use of computer animation.
Really?
It was the clock years and everything. So
And
you know, one more thing about it is just the part where the song "Let Me Be Good to You."
It was
almost considered too risque, and they almost took it out.
Wait. Who sang? Was that Tina Turner? Who was that? Who sang that song?
I don't remember who it was in the animation part of it. I don't remember who was singing it, but it was a cabaret song.
Okay, and gotcha.
They said since it was a mouse, not a human, there was no question it was harmless in the lyrics and everything. So,
okay. All right.
It was an interesting movie, so to speak.
No, it's one of those that a lot of people still love to put on, and it's stood the test of time with its storytelling. And of course its animation. I didn't know that about the computer animation. That's fascinating. And I think our friend Matthew Clifton is also a big fan of that movie as well. So
nice.
I want to mention, of course, Big Trouble in Little China, directed by John Carpenter, and of course starring Kurt Russell as Jack Burton and the lovely Kim Cattrall as Gracie Law. James Hong, great character actor who played David Lopan. This was one of the, you know, it's kind of interesting. Part of this reminds me, it feels like John Carpenter and some of it does not. I just watched it recently, but the soundtrack is so John Carpenter because it was something that John Carpenter liked to actually compose himself or make sure that he would do. But it was just a great, fun adventure film. And I loved Kurt Russell's Jack Burton in this film. He is so cocky. And one of my favorite lines is towards the end where, you know, he's looking at Kim Cattrall. Kim Cattrall's got those little dreamy eyes after everyone's been kind of rescued, and she's looking at him leaning up against the post. And then everyone sees this, and I think Kim Cattrall's friend goes, "Aren't you going to kiss her goodbye?" And he looks at her going, "Nah." It's just a really good film. Did you guys have anything you want to say on that movie?
I haven't seen it for a very long time.
Well, I'm sorry, Aaron. Sorry, you go first.
Oh, sorry. I mean, I of course, big Sex and the City fan, and Kim Cattrall, and she done quite a few films during the 80s with Mannequin and stuff like that. Right. Look, it was fun. I saw that probably as you did in those days. I'm going to the cinema again. So it was like would have been four or five times. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
What about you, David?
I haven't seen it for 20 years.
So what, hold on, you haven't seen for 20 years? Wow.
Yeah, no, it's been a long
time. Davis, what about you?
Oh, I thought it was a fun movie. I just remember one of the scenes where Kurt Russell's shooting the gun up in the air, and all of a sudden the ceiling comes down upon him and everything. Kim Cattrall, I always had a little bit of a crush on her, so I loved her when she became Valeris.
Oh, yes, Valeris. And, of course, as Aaron mentioned, Mannequin. I loved Mannequin. But, yeah, she was great as Valeris. She was one of my favorite parts about that movie, Star Trek, The Undiscovered Country. I was trying to see what else. I did not see Under the Cherry Moon. I remember seeing Purple Rain, but this movie, I was just like, no, I'm not interested in it. Club Paradise, I do remember seeing this. This was a funny comedy. Davis, did you see this film?
No, I have not seen this film.
Well, it was one of those Harold Ramis-directed films, and Harry Shearer also was one of the writers. A lot of these funny, like, one-shot comedies were coming out, but Robin Williams was in it, Peter O'Toole, Rick Moranis. I do remember enjoying it at the time, but you know, it was one of those movies that I think that doesn't really stand the test of time, in my opinion. What else do we have here? I did not see Vamp till years later on VHS. Now, Aaron, I know you're kind of the horror expert here. Did you see Vamp? Did you like it?
I saw it on VHS. Again, I'm not a massive comedy horror fan.
Okay.
I think it was sort of Grace Jones that had that Chris Makepeace.
Yes.
Remember My Bodyguard?
Yeah.
That was a good film.
Really, really good movie.
So, and I think he might have done a Meatballs or something, never to be seen again. So it was, I think it was mainly known for the cover more than anything else. So I wasn't a big fan. Psycho 3, I saw VHS, known because of Anthony Perkins directed it. And it's actually not a bad third film. And the sequel's good too. So as Psychos went, as a, you know, continuing films, they actually weren't too bad, the sequel and then the third one. So he actually directed that. But other than that, it was pretty sort of forgettable for me.
Well, we
moved on. I didn't see anything else.
Nothing else? Okay, cool. Then we go into the last half of July. On July 25th, we had Haunted Honeymoon, Heartburn, Maximum Overdrive, Out of Bounds, The Patriot, Robotech the Movie. July 7th, we had a movie called As Is, and July 30th, we had Nothing in Common. Davis, I want to start with you. Does any of these films jump out at you?
Not really, no. I remember the Maximum Overdrive, and I think I watched it because Emilio Estevez was in it, but
yeah,
I just don't remember anything about that movie.
Well, it's interesting because Stephen King was kind of blowing up, and this was one of those movies that had a rock and roll soundtrack as well, and it was directed by Stephen King as well, which we thought was interesting. But yeah, it starred Emilio Estevez, Pat Hingle, Laura Harrington, Yeardley Smith played Connie, and of course she is more famously known as the voice of Lisa Simpson. And this, of course, was the great soundtrack that also had AC/DC and pretty much spotlighted AC/DC. And I think for a lot of people, discovered AC/DC for the first time and became fans, like myself. I didn't get into AC/DC in the earlier albums. This was the film that turned me on to AC/DC. And then once then, it was over. I was a huge fan of that. So big, big fan of that. Aaron, was there any of these films that jumped out at you?
Maximum Overdrive, again, more known for the soundtrack than it was for the film, I think.
I think you're right.
As you said. It's more known for the soundtrack. Gotcha. Because AC/DC, other than Iron Man 2, or was it 3? Actually, I've never done like a best of. I think it is Iron Man 3. So, yeah, it was more known for the soundtrack than it had Emilio Estevez and there was a truck. There you go.
Yeah.
That's it.
One of the films I wanted to touch base on, because I remember seeing it shortly after when it came out on VHS, completely forgot about it for years. And I was going through some used LP bins and came across the soundtrack for this film. And I'm like, oh, this is pretty good songs on here. I'm like, I haven't seen this film in a while. And I found it on VHS and it was Out of Bounds, starring Anthony Michael Hall and Jenny Wright. It's about a farm boy, Daryl, whose parents ship him off to the big city to live with his brother, hoping he will have a better life. After a baggage mix up at the airport, Daryl finds himself in big trouble because I think there's like cocaine and money in there. And then he starts going on the run. And, but it had a really good soundtrack. It was one of those Anthony Michael Hall, I'm not the geeky guy anymore type leading role. I'm trying to do something different. And it was actually pretty good. And then also had the really cute Jenny Wright in it, known for me for Near Dark, which came out next year in 87. She hasn't done a lot of stuff since then. The last thing she did was in 1998. And so there's a lot of fans of Near Dark. They're like, where's Jenny Wright? And what's she been up to? And she was in Lawnmower Man and Young Guns too. But, it's one of those films, if you get a chance to see it, it was actually enjoyable. I thought Anthony Michael Hall was really good in it. So
she was also in Sinelmo's Fire playing Rob Lowe's wife, who he didn't love.
Oh, that's right.
They had that scene where he has to fight with the boyfriend and then they kiss and he's got blood all over his mouth and we all thought, oh, he's all sweaty. That was another, you know, getting us through a dark night scenes.
Right.
She disappeared. Like, I've read articles. I think Adrian Pasta, who was in Near Dark, and people have asked and said, whatever happened to her? And like, not like disappeared as in like disappeared, but she is so gone off the radar and has just turned it back on Hollywood. Yeah. And so no one actually knows what she's doing. She's whether she's even alive, I suppose. But
The Robotech
who knows? Someone out there might know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, if you let us know, please let us know on the Phantom Podcast Network. Let's get an exclusive interview. Also, Robotech the movie came out. I did not see this in the theater. I was I had to wait till video later on to see it, or DVD, but I was obviously into the week-to-week TV series. Davis, were you? Did you see this movie when it first came out?
No, I didn't. I didn't see that until much, much later on, and I've just now started my rewatch of Robotech since it's now on Netflix, so I'm going through that.
It's so good. I love that one. So there was some other movie. I did not see Haunted Honeymoon, Heartburn. Did not see The Patriot. There was Nothing in Common. This was the Tom Hanks film directed by Gary Marshall, who recently passed away. Comedy legend. Jackie Gleason was in it as well. It was Jackie Gleason and a successful man, Hanks, must juggle his ever-demanding career while his parents' marriage breaks up. I never did see this film. It looked kind of like the serious version of Tom Hanks that we weren't quite ready for at the time, because he was the funny guy from Booze and Buddies and Bachelor Party. So I never saw this. Did you guys see this at all? Aaron, start with you. No? What about you, Davis?
No.
You know, it looks so familiar, and I may have seen it like on VHS, like a year or two later or something like that, but it just looks familiar. And I think it was actually a pretty funny movie, but I think it was also drama because it was, you know, all that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about Aliens. This, now, we could spend a whole special on this particular movie, but we can't. We don't have the time. So, but we do we do want to touch on this first. And Aaron, I'm going to start with you because I know you're a huge fan for several reasons. And you and I actually, well, you know, when I was over there in London and Scotland and doing my massive tour over there in Ireland, and eventually going to end up for London for the Star Wars celebration. You were doing your little Highlander tour there. You were on vacation. You were there for a while. And you met up with me and my really good friend, David Rasmussen. And we went to go see in London the 30th anniversary showing of this movie, the original version on the big screen there in London, which was great. But I want you, you know, tell us, you know, how did this movie impact you? Did you see it when it first came out? Let's start with there about when you first saw it.
Yes. This came out later in Australia. So this came out a day after my birthday. So November 6, 1986. Now, I would have seen this a few times. I was dating like my first boyfriend, Darren, at the time, and we went to see it. And I specifically remember the scene when Ripley goes in to see Newt and they fall asleep underneath the cot. And then, of course, the face huggers are let loose. And he had my hand. He was holding my hand, as you do when you're like, you know, 16, 17. And he nearly broke it because he hated spiders. And that's what reminded him of it. So that's what reminds me of Aliens. Loved Alien. Aliens was amazing. Of course, a totally different film. James Cameron directed it. It was funny. I read an article with him saying that he found it hard because he took over Ridley Scott and had half his crew in, because they filmed it in London, and he had just made Terminator. A lot of them were like, oh, who's this upstart kid? And he's like, I've made this little film. Maybe you should check out what I've done. And, of course, it was Terminator. So I am like a walking advertisement for 986. I have two massive tattoos, one of the Alien Queen on my back. Yes, it goes right across my back, and a Highlander Kurgan fight scene on my arm. So I'm pretty much 1986.
Give a shout out to your tattoo artist.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So my lovely Kane at Fox Body Art in Melbourne. If you ever want to look at his Instagram, he is Kane_Melbourne. On Instagram. He does amazing stuff. He's done both tattoos. He's a great comic artist. So his stuff is more comic related, amazing. And I just fell in love. The thing is, and I think don't think a lot of people realize, is that the Alien Queen is a is James Cameron. It's not Geiger. It's Geiger inspired but James Cameron, who is an artist, he was a graphic artist, actually created the design for the Alien Queen. So as much as it is a Geiger-inspired look, the actual Alien Queen is James Cameron himself. So,
now, yeah. There's one thing, Aaron, I want you to touch on. It was a conversation that you and I were having, I think, in London. And I thought it was fascinating. It's something you and I disagree on. And it is how you feel about the original version of Aliens compared to the special edition. And I would like you to tell the listeners why you prefer the original and why you do not like the special edition for your reasons.
I think it runs better. I think it runs smoother. I think it flows better.
You're talking about the original.
The original, yeah. So the original version, the only thing that I think with the original version was a little bit that the special edition sort of cleared up was the fact that they were all dissing Ripley when she was saying there was an alien and, you know, this is what happened. And they're like, we never found anyone on LV-26. And then suddenly, you know, they've been there for however years, you know, 50 years or whatever it was. And then 2 seconds later, Burke's knocking on the door saying we've lost contact. And that was sort of a little bit like, well, that was a bit of a coincidence, where in the special edition, you know that he sent out a family which incorporated Newt out to look for this ship that Ripley, of course, talked about, which then ended up being in Prometheus and all that sort of stuff. And that's where it all starts with the aliens. So that's probably about, I'm still not a fan of it. I just think it runs better. I think there was a lot of scenes that were added that it flowed. We didn't have to know about. I'm not a massive one for backstory. Mm-hmm. Some things you don't have to know about. So it's just always flowed. I'm like that with Terminator 2 as well. I don't need to know the extra stuff in Terminator 2.
Those are good points. I'm glad you brought those up. Because,
I hate more than the scene where he suddenly was saying, you know, my name's Dwayne, or I'm Ellen, and I'm just like, oh, okay. So just ruined it. So, yeah, so that killed it for me. But other than that, I mean, it's a totally opposite film to Aliens, the same with, Terminator. Terminator 2 with Alien. It's amazing. I love it. There's so many lines, you know, with Hudson of the game over, with, you know, Michael Biehn was cast 3 seconds before, literally, I think the weekend before, because James Remar had a fallout with James Cameron with the Hicks part. He is actually in the film, but you can only see him from behind. They kept one scene in with him in it. So, you know, there's the missing Burke scene that I had the original Aliens. Remember you get those fan books? It was like a magazine.
Oh, yeah.
And I wish I still had it. It'd probably be worth hundreds. And there was a scene of Burke cocooned. And you were like watching the film going, hello, where's this scene? And it's back in the special edition. It's back, not in there, but there's a scene where when Ripley goes to find Newt at the end, she comes across Burke, because you never know what happens to Burke. You see the alien attack him, but then that was it, and he is cocooned. And she actually hands him a grenade and leads him. So it's just the thing of, you know, he has a choice of either becoming what he is or blow himself up. And they decided that Ripley wouldn't have been that heartless, so they took it out. So that was interesting to see finally after years of that scene to come back in, because you always think, I've dreamt that. I dreamt it somewhere. Well, but, yeah, it was wonderful.
What about you, Davis? Did you see it when it first came out, or did you wait for video and touch on the special edition in the regular theatrical release?
I did not see that in the original theatrical release. I actually waited until – do you remember the HBO Showtime type of channel Encore?
Right, right.
Yeah, they actually released that on there, and they had a behind the scenes to it, so you got to see like the behind the scenes before the movie actually started. So you got to see like how James Cameron said, since you're all Marines, I want you to actually personalize your armor. That was one of the cool things about it. One of the other things was Bill Paxton, you know, he was improvising his lines a lot. That's where we got the game over, man, game over. The really other cool thing I liked during the behind the scenes was that Bill Paxton was always apologizing every time he swore to Newt. I think it was Carrie Wren, because he was like, I'm sorry, I don't mean to swear in front of you. And she goes, I don't know what the words mean. It's okay. But I love the movie. I thought it was just a great world building to build off from the first movie. And, you know, I actually recently listened to the audio adaption to Covenant, where they talk in between the two movies. And I really am hoping that there is a sequel to this one where it takes off a different path than Alien 3 did.
Gotcha. You know, hold on a sec, guys. I'm going to see if we can get a special guest in on here. Hold on one moment, because I have a certain take on this movie that I'm a little embarrassed to say about. But hold on, I'll tell you. Let me get our friend in here to talk. All right, we're calling here. Hopefully he picks up here in a second. Hello?
Hello.
All right, now hold on. We got a special guest here. We got Norman Lau. We're talking aliens right now, Norman. So hold on one second. I'm gonna give you guys my take on aliens real quick. So first of all, when the original Alien came out, I remember it was the time that my parents let me stay at home and watch my younger brother. That's where I think I was watching like Silver Spoons and a bunch of these other TV shows that were coming out. That might have been a little bit later, but I remember my parents went on a date to go see the original Alien. Something happened. They got in an argument. They came home, and my mom was furious. She went straight to the bedroom, and my dad was pissed off. And I was really curious about Alien because I'd seen some commercials for it, and it seemed really scary. And I said, Dad, how is Alien? I'm not going to tell you exactly what he said because he used some profanity, but he basically said, you're not going to like it. You're going to puke. And that's all he said. So that actually scared me. That traumatized me. So I never did see Alien when it first came out. Of course, I was young at the time. And when Aliens was announced, I was really curious about it, especially the trailers. It looked like this kind of like action film. So I actually saw Aliens before I saw Alien. And I did not see Aliens in the theater because I was underage at the time, and they were really strict on letting people in, and you know, my dad didn't want to see it at the time, and so I had to wait for it to come out on video, and then eventually I went and saw Alien, and I was like, oh my God, these movies are so good. But for me, when I finally did see it, they did release it in the theater later on. I do remember seeing it in the theater. But for me, it was just the perfect sci-fi movie, and I remember some of my friends that were huge fan of the original Alien, they were a little put off by it because it wasn't this, you know, it wasn't this scary. It didn't have the kind of horror feeling to it. And, but for me, I was like, I didn't care. It had everything I wanted. It had space marines. I loved the camaraderie between them. Sigourney Weaver was my new hero. For me, she was one of the first female action heroes that, you know, I didn't look at differently because she was a woman. She was just badass, and this, you know, there's just so many quotable lines in this film. I think between all of us here, Kyle, by the way, are you around? I don't know if he's listening.
Yeah, I figured I would pop in for a minute.
Okay, cool. So we got online here. We've got my fellow podcast fandom podcast cohorts. Kyle, introduce yourself.
Of course, Kyle Wagner here, co-host of Culture Clash with Mr. Raider Nerd Kevin Reitzel and co-founder of the Fandom Podcast Network.
And it's Norman, an honor to be ahead, here. Go ahead and chime in.
This is Norm. I'm in the pipe 5x5.
See, that's the thing right now. I think between all of us, we could probably quote this line, this movie line for line all the way through. And that's one of the things I love about this movie is that you could be kind of nerding out with someone. You could say one of these lines and then someone could just say either the next line or something from it. And everything is just so quotable. And we have all of our favorite characters from this film. Let me start with you, Kyle. What would you say, you know, I got to get your take on Aliens real quick. What is your take?
Well, I think to this day, it is one of the sci-fi / horror sci-fi movies ever made. I think it easily goes down in the pantheon of one of the top 10 classic films of all time, as far as like what I would call a cult classic. I saw this movie in the theater. I was definitely underage to see it, but Buddy's dad was a big fan of the original movie. It was his birthday. He wanted us to come see it with him, so we went and saw it. And I was listening a little earlier. Aaron was talking about the scene with Burke and how that was in the book but not in the movie. When I saw it, there was actually a scene in the movie, the scene with the auto guns where they're taking out all the aliens as they're approaching.
Yes.
I saw that in the cut in the theater I saw. It didn't make it to the VHS, but then it was back in the special edition.
It's funny you say that because the first time I saw that was when you saw the heavily edited version on broadcast television. And in order to make up for a lot of stuff they had to cut out, they put those scenes back in. And that was the first time I saw it.
Yeah, but I mean, so like you said, between all of us here, we could probably recite this movie word for word. It's probably the most quotable movie in the history of Hollywood.
Agreed. Norman, I know you're itching to say something about Aliens. What you got, man?
Well, Aliens, it's one of those James Cameron movies that just pushes the envelope. Every single movie that he released changes the landscape of cinema in some way, and Aliens is no different. And I think that it really redefined the action, adventure, science fiction, horror genre. You have to actually put all of those descriptors in this movie because it covers all of that. Now, yes, it's a traditionally not probably the same tone as Alien, but I think that because of Aliens, a lot of people went back to actually watch Alien. And
that's what I did, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what I did too. And for me, I think that one of the most memorable parts of Aliens is the soundtrack, because James Horner crushed that soundtrack.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was really good.
So I loved it. I mean, yeah. And I mean, you know, the M41A pulse rifle, everyone loves that. The smart guns, you know, even Where's Bowski gets respect, probably the least seen character on screen.
Hey, I've got a really cool alien quick story on Aliens if you guys want to hear it.
Yeah, go for it.
Yep.
Just want to talk about how cool Lance Hendrickson is. Several years ago, I was at a convention, and the reason why this is an alien story, you'll understand in just a moment. He was at the convention, and a couple of Marines walked up to him to get his autograph, and they had just come back from over in the Middle East. And he asked them to please wait a minute. He disappeared for about 15 minutes, came back with two cases, opened them up, and they were Colonial Marine rifles. And he gave them to those guys and said, thank you for your service. These were used in the film.
Wow.
That's awesome.
That's so cool.
That's really, really cool. I have to mention something, because Norm, I think you and I are in a similar boat where we didn't see Alien until later on. After I saw Aliens on VHS, and then I went back and saw Alien and put them together, a friend of mine made this suggestion, and I made, you know how when we would record movies on different speeds on the VHS to get them on to the VHSs, where you would record the SP speed would be the best quality. You would have the one movie on SP, and usually your favorite movie would be in that. Then you had the LP speed, which you could put two movies on, and then you had the EP speed, where you could put like six movies if they were all under like 2 hours.
2 hours, 4 hours, and 6 hours.
Yes. Yep. Okay. So, but here's the thing, though. What I did was, is I had this special VCR that I got that was from, I think, you know those VCRs that you'd see in school? They weren't fancy, but you would just put in the tape. They didn't have any special features on them or anything like that, and you would watch whatever educational thing was. I remember buying one of those used, but it was great. What was great about those is it didn't have the protection that it would pick up on VHS tape, so I could record any movie that I rented and put it on any blank tape. I decided to do this Aliens mega cut of the film, because at the very end of Aliens, when you see Ripley in the Nostromo, is that the name of the ship, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. It's floating in space, and then the credits start to roll. Well, right before the credits start to roll, I paused my recorder, then put in Aliens, where you see the ship, and then hit record again. So I had this mega four and a half hour version of Aliens mega cut with like no credits. But then at the end of Aliens, I went back and did include the alien credits at the end of it.
That's awesome.
Nerd.
Okay, real quick, before we wrap up Aliens here, I want to ask everyone, starting with you, Aaron, who is your favorite, let's say this, other than Ripley, because we all love Ellen Ripley, other than Ripley, who is your favorite character, and give me a line from a film, whether it is from that person or not. Who is your favorite character in Alien?
Oh, it has to be Vasquez.
Yeah.
And you know, the scene where Hudson says, you know, Vasquez, is anyone ever, you know, oh, it's going to totally come out of my brain, but I would mistake you for a man. She turned around. Has anyone, you know, have you?
Oh, yes.
I've totally buggered that up. But, you know, the one where she's doing the pull-up on the
great scene.
And with Drake, who I always reckon would be. Yeah, always
Vasquez, you're just too badass.
Oh, yeah. Let's rock.
Davis, what about you? Who is your favorite character other than Ellen Ripley? And give me a line from the film.
I got to say, it's got to be Hicks. I mean, he was the leader of the group, and he realized he was in over his head and they had to get out. I think one of the things I liked was when he said, "Eat this." one really cool thing, real quick. I have this company called Marauder Inc., which actually makes weapons for 3¾-inch scale figures. And they actually released the Pulse rifle for my G.I. Joe figures. And I have all of them equipped with the Pulse rifle.
That is so cool.
Nice. You're welcome.
Are they detailed?
Oh, they are completely detailed. I'll send some pictures up on my Facebook and tag you on them.
That's awesome. Kyle, who's your favorite non-Ellen Ripley character? And give me a quote.
Well, I think if I give you a quote, everybody will just know it. So all I gotta say is, "Game over, man! Game over."
So is Hudson your favorite character?
Yeah, Hudson. Okay. Bill Paxton was just so great in that film. I mean, and of course, the man is the first man to go down in history to be killed by a Terminator, an alien, and a Predator.
That's right. I'm so glad you brought that up, man. That's why I love you, Kyle, because you know that stuff. You just know it. Norman, who is your favorite non-Ellen Ripley character, and give me a quote.
Well, a lot of them have been chosen, so I want to go a little bit off tangent here because I think that Apone is awesome, and yes. I mean he has like the best quote. He's like, you know, I love the core. You know, every meal is a banquet, every paycheck is a fortune, every formation a parade. I love the core.
Look in my eye.
Look into my eye.
My favorite character is Kyle's favorite. I absolutely love Private Hudson, played by Bill Paxton. He has some of the best lines, like "Put her in charge." But one of my favorites, and I'm going to try and bleep it here, is when they catch Paul Reiser's character of what he tried to do to Ripley and Newt. And he goes up to him, "Let's give this rat F son of a SUB." And that's when everyone in the audience was like, "Yes, grease him, kill him, kill him." And we all cheered during that scene. But he had so many scene stealing moments, some great lines. And one of my good friends, Bob, who I was in a band with in Santa Barbara, and we still talk all the time, we both agreed that if anyone were other than, you know, Sigourney Weaver, if anyone was going to get a Oscar nomination, I would have given it to Private Hudson, you know, especially when he goes, yeah, you know, let Bishop do it. Cause you know, he's kind of the chicken, you know, but he has redemption at the end when he gives himself up and he's firing his gun. He goes, "Oh, you want some, come get some. And he just goes down in, like, you know, this heroic, you know, way of, you know, delaying the aliens from getting the rest of the crew. And he is definitely my favorite character. So now I just want to give Aliens due. Is there any particular quick story someone wanted to mention before we move on from Aliens?
I have a question.
Oh, just a quick one.
Okay.
Oh,
wait, Norman, you go first and then I'll come.
No, Aaron, go ahead. Go ahead. And I'm sorry. I didn't say hi. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. How are you? Oh, good.
Go ahead.
Just a quick one. Just what reminds me of it, when I was working at Forbidden Planet London, late 90s, and we had a guy there, Kevin, who worked in merchandise, and he, during that time at the Trocadero, they actually had an Aliens, like a game, like not a ride, but you could go in, and they actually used some of the costumes from Aliens. And he was a Marine, and he was American, and he had been a Marine, so it wasn't a long stretch for him. But and you would go in there, and it was sort of like you would go through, and they would come out, and aliens would jump out, and the Marines would jump out, and you sort of walk through this sort of ride, aliens ride. But I remember one Christmas at Forbidden Planet, and I was in the old shop downstairs in New Oxford Street, and it was packed, as you would
thing during, you know, Christmas time. And I remember him coming down saying, "Game over, man, game over. They're coming out of the walls. They're coming out of the walls," from all the customers everywhere. And it just made me laugh. And I will always think of him and Hudson together, because he would just do the perfect line through the, you know, the intercom all the way through, and just kept us laughing. And it will always, I will always have those two together. It was quite amazing.
Gotcha. Well, as you know, we could probably say that this is one of those films that is still, it's interesting too, because before we move on from Aliens, we have to mention too that the subculture and the fan base for this movie is still so huge, and particularly this film in the chapter of the Alien quadrilogy that's out there. And I'm not counting the Aliens versus Predators. I'm talking about, you know, the four main ones. And there's debate on, you know, which ones people like more and least. But this is the film that everyone loves. Everyone quotes. There's even a costuming group of, you know, the Space Marines. And you always see these fantastic aliens and such. And this one, it's just timeless. It's a great film. Everyone, I don't know anyone who's seen this film and not like it. So, as we move on, though, there's a reason why I brought Kyle in and I brought Norman in. We want to talk about. I want each of them to talk about a specific movie that is near and dear to their heart. Norman, I'm going to come to you after Kyle, so be ready. Mm-hmm. Kyle, I want you to talk. I want you to give us a few minutes about Robotech and what it means to you and how it's affected you.
Well, when we talk the Robotech movie, that is an interesting case study in 80s anime, because the Robotech movie was basically spawned off the popularity of Robotech when it first came out, and they were looking for something to do. And here's the crazy thing about the Robotech movie. What they did is they found an anime called Megazone 23, and they edited parts of Robotech into Megazone 23 to make it the Robotech movie. Now, granted, there was none of the main characters from Robotech in this cut of Robotech the movie. A couple of the secondary characters were edited in to make an appearance. The plot point of Megazone 23 was that everybody thought they were on a planet, and it turns out they were on this large ship that they tried to spin off as the SDF-1. It was like people discovering they weren't really, who thought they were still on the planet, but they're actually on the SDF-1. It wasn't until several years later that Megazone 23 got its own release into anime lore. But the thing about the Robotech movie was that at the time, it's one of the first anime movies that they tried to really push in America. And it kind of found its cult place, but it just didn't take off. And I think it's because a lot of people were expecting what they had seen on the TV, and they didn't get it in this film, and it actually upset a lot of people. And I think if you talk to a lot of people, the Robotech movie kind of pushed back anime releases in theaters until Akira came out a few years later in 88, 89. So the Robotech film is kind of one of those movies that really kind of they had all the intentions were good, but they just, it didn't take off. And I don't think it helped either that the other big mecha an animated movie that came out that year was Transformers.
Right. I think obviously Transformers is a lot more popular, but you know, it's an interesting point you make about that, because I do remember hearing about that from some of my anime fans about Robotech. But I think it caught legs on video a little bit later, though, when nostalgia kind of started kicking a little bit more, would you say?
Yeah, I would think so. And never got really a great official release, and it's been years since anybody's put out the cut, mainly because of Harmony Gold and how they are, and they really don't. And then you got rights issues, because they did eventually release Megazone 23 Part 1 and 2 as two separate films that are available on VHS and DVD here in the U.S. That's kind of the thing with Robotech the movie. It's like, it's not an easy find anymore. So it's kind of one of those things, if you come across it somewhere, it's worth giving a check out for its place in history.
Well, a little shout out to did the Fandom Flashback, which was the last one that we did for Robotech, and we also had voice actor and famous all around actor and thespian himself is Richard Epcar, so we had him on there as well. Did you want to touch briefly on that special?
When we did Robotech Phantom Flashback, we hit a lot of things. But again, I give a shout out to one of our good buddies down there in Australia, Adam O'Brien. He helped facilitate us getting Richard Epcar on the show.
Thank you.
And
yes.
What was so great about Richard Epcar, I mean, the man has done so much in voice acting, but in a lot of other acting. But what was fun, the thing that stands out about when he talked about Robotech, because he also talked about Ghost in the Shell, which he is probably the most famous for, but his Robotech was, he literally forgot for 10 years that he had done Robotech until they asked him to come back for a special 10-year anniversary con. And he was like, I was in that? Just to give you an idea how many roles this man has done, he did about three or four voices in Robotech. So
we also had Kevin McKeever on, who is with Harmony Gold, to break some news about some upcoming projects, including the long-awaited, anticipated, possible live-action version of Robotech. So hopefully we'll hear more about that. But he was kind enough to come on our show right around Comic-Con came out to help promote that. And, you know, it was also coming up later on. So, well, Kyle, thank you so much for talking about that. Now, we're gonna stay a little bit longer here in July because we want to go back and touch on a movie that I talked briefly about. Unfortunately, though, Norman had to step away, but in his place we have Lo Pan.
How dare you make me wait so long, ancient petulant child. How dare you? I am going to send you to hell with a body light and skin alive and sex symbol. Why am I here? Why have you summoned me here?
Well, Mr. Lo Pan, we wanted to talk about, you know, Big Trouble in Little China. And my good friend Norman is a huge fan of this film. And I had to make sure that he came on to talk about this. Would you mind letting him out of the wheelchair that he has been tied to and maybe say a few words?
Oh, very well. I must talk to Mr. Ching Dai Yi and let him allow my spirit to inhabit this worthless human being.
Norman, whoa, are you there?
Whoa, what happened? Where did I go?
Well, I'm glad you escaped. We know you're a big fan of Big Trouble in Little China. I was wondering if you could... give us your feeling on this movie.
Big Trouble in Little China is probably the one movie that I'm going to say is probably more quotable than Aliens, in my opinion. I think
that's saying a lot, man.
The character of Jack Burton he's a rock and roller that rolls into town as a hero, but he's not a hero. And he basically just falls head over heels into this Chinese spiritual civil war. And he has no idea what he's doing, but he ends up kind of saving the day at the end. And of course, he knows that it's just because it's all in the reflexes.
What is it about this film that resonates with you so much? Because I know how passionate you are.
Well, I think up until this point, like all of our heroes were these very archetypal heroes. You know, your Indiana Jones, you know, he was a hero or anti-hero, but you know, he was this well-educated professor of antiquity. He knew exactly what he was doing. So you had all of these very strong, very well-centered male leads kind of pushing the narrative as the hero needed to be. But now you have Jack Burton, and especially and only can be played, in my opinion, by Kurt Russell. He's just a guy. There's no Navy SEAL training. There's no SWAT training. There's no professors of antiquities training and a master of bullwhip on the side. He's just a trucker, right? He's a trucker with a heart of gold. And he's like, you know what? All I want is my truck back. I could care less about your Chinese mumbo jumbo and all this nonsense. Just let me go about my business. Oh, by the way, I do have some pretty good reflexes. And, you know, I'm just a guy. You know, I'm a pretty normal guy. I mean, I'm a reasonable guy, but I think I've just experienced some very unreasonable things. That's what he would say. So,
well, I want you to touch base on a couple of your favorite characters in this film, other than Mr. Jack Burton. We had to hear from Mr. Lo Pan, played by James Hong. I know you're a fan of his as well. Touch on some of the characters and actors in this film.
Well, I think that's probably the big secret of this film is that all the characters are really endearing in their own kind of quirky ways. You know, Jack Burton is just this like ne'er-do-well trucker hero. And then you have Wang Chi, who is his best friend, and you know, because they're both Californian and all. And they're friends, you know. And by the way, Wang Chi has connections to like this interesting spiritual Chinese underworld. it's one of these kind of movies that just has the weirdest logic and narrative, but it all seems to work. So you have Wang Chi, his kind of, you know, his buddy. Then you have Gracie Law, who's kind of like a lawyer who's in over her head because she wants to find the story on the Chinese underground. Then you have Lo Pan and the Wing Kong import export exchange. You'd have Egg Shen, you know, who is this kind of, you know, he's like the homeless crazy hermit wizard mad scientist kind of guy who's like the Obi-Wan of Chinatown. No one pays attention to him until he really starts to show like who he is and what he's all about. You know, you have Uncle Chu, you have Eddie, you have Marco. It's just, you have this great cast of characters, and
can I throw out one cast of character that to me has become iconic with 80s and early 90s action films?
Who?
Mr. Al Leong.
Oh, absolutely.
He was in the beginning of the film as the Wing Kong hatchet man, and he is very distinctive. He's got the long hair and this big Fu Manchu thing going on. You may remember him from the candy bar eating terrorist in Die Hard. You remember him in Brandon Lee's Rapid Fire and many other action films as that bad guy, or otherwise known, and my friends, it's that guy.
Yeah, well, he was also in Lethal Weapon. You know, he said now his chins like dished out more punishment than any man could have ever
That's
known.
That's right. He's the one that tortures
Mel Gibson.
Rick. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I gotta take a breath here because I'm just like talking a mile a minute, but one of the reasons why I think Big Trouble in Little China is a staple 80s movie is because it does for me exactly what 80s movies set out to do. And it set out to try something different. It was just off the wall, screwball, action, horror. It just threw everything at the wall and see what stuck. And if some things worked, they worked. And if they didn't, they didn't. But thank God for home video, because it went from like zero to hero because of VHS home video release.
I did. Yeah. I remember I caught it on VHS years later. I did not see it in the theater. So, well, I'm really glad that you came on to talk about it. Is there any last things you'd like to say about that awesome movie?
Oh, the fight scene at the end, because it has martial arts and it has lightning throwing, also the inspiration for Raiden in Mortal Kombat, lightning. It has this great neon 80s look between all of the neon that was interlaced with all the Chinese architecture. It's just, gosh, what can I say about it? Oh, hey,
okay. Well, let me ask you one last thing, because I did quote before you got on. I did quote one of my favorite lines towards the end when you see Kim Cattrall kind of looking kind of all sexy and demure and wondering whether they're going to kiss or not. And they said, "Aren't you going to kiss her?" And then Jack looked at her going, "No,
no." Yep.
Give me a good Jack Burton line.
Well, I am, you know, as I podcast, I like to pour myself a little bit of a libation. So I'd like to raise my glass and I'd like to look at all of my podcast friends out there as I stare into my monitor and just say, here's to the Army and Navy and the battles they have won. Here's to America's colors, the colors that never run. And then Jack Burton would say, may the wings of liberty never lose a feather.
Nice. Well, Norman and Kyle, feel free to hang around. We're going to go ahead and jump into August here. We've got some really good films in August.
Yeah, I might have to jump in on one of those in August.
That's fine. Let's start with I'm going to go ahead and list them off here. And then, Davis, I'm going to jump to you on a couple of these here. August 1st, we had a movie called Choke Canyon, Flight of the Navigator, Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives, Good to Go, Howard the Duck. On August 8th, we had One Crazy Summer, She's Gotta Have It, Stand By Me, Transformers the Movie, which we just touched on with Kyle. I'm with Robotech. Sorry, we'll get into Transformers here. That's what I want to have you on as well. August 13th, we had Half Moon Street. August 15th, we had Armed and Dangerous, The Fly, and Manhunter. August 22nd, we had Extremities, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, and, of course, everyone's favorite, Shanghai Surprise, on August 29th. I was being facetious there. So, Davis, I want to start with you. I want you to pick one or two of these right now. Any of these stand out for you right here?
Flight of the Navigator and Howard the Duck, 4,000, please.
Okay, give me a quick lowdown on Flight of the Navigator. Why is that one special to you? Because I know it's one of those cult films that people love, and it's one of those great kid adventure films that everyone kind of, you know, gravitated to from a certain age.
Well, it's also kind of a hope movie because, I mean, the main character of the movie actually disappears for 8 years. And as everyone who's raised in the 80s, there was always, not to put it lightly or anything, but there was someone or some little boy or little girl who went missing, and we were always told to stay where you are no matter what, all the time. And, you know, to have him come back 8 years later, I mean, can you imagine seeing how life has passed beyond you and seeing how everyone else has grown up and everything? So, I mean, it was just a good movie overall. And one of the cool things I do like about it is the prop of the ship itself was actually in the boneyard of the MGM Studios, which is now at the in Tomorrowland. It's on top of one of the fixtures of the drink station in Tomorrowland. It's on top of there now.
Okay.
It's actually refurbished and everything. And Howard the Duck. I mean, who doesn't love a good Marvel movie? Come on.
The first official Marvel movie, so to speak?
Probably part of the first official Marvel Cinematic Universe. You know, George Lucas had just finished Star Wars, as we all know, and he was looking. He had also just built a $50 million ranch, Skywalker Ranch, so he was looking to make some money back. And one reason why this movie is so significant is because the movie bombed, but because it bombed, his good friend Stephen Jobs said, I'll take your little animation part and, you know, help you out. That animation division of Lucasfilm became what we all know is Pixar.
Oh, yeah. They kind of went on to do some successful stuff, didn't they?
I think they did. I think they're still around. Call me crazy, but I think they are. And, you know, I mean, that's just one of those. It's just one of those fun movies where you're just going, why am I watching this again? And, you know, it's just going to happen like that. But I do think that one of the coolest things at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy is he reappears. And I think it was on the anniversary when that movie was released. It was around that same time.
What a great little cameo. That was just awesome. Oh, you know, it was funny. There was an age check in the theater at Guardians of the Galaxy because there was a lot of young people going, well, I don't get it. And then you hear these you hear these collective laughs, and you're looking around going, you're old as me. Gotcha. Yeah. Aaron, I want to go to you next. Out of these films, which one jumps out at you? I know you got a couple here on the list. Start with one.
Stand By Me and The Fly. Just so amazing. And Manhunter, I think. They're the three big ones.
Well, let's start with Stand By Me. This was probably a coming of age film that we all enjoyed.
Yeah, so I think of the 80s, the two of the sort of coming of age for me were The Goonies and Stand By Me, which, again, for 80s films, always have an underlying sort of darkness to them. I mean, even in The Goonies, the Fratellis were out to kill those kids. So I think it's not so High School Musical as it is now. The 80s always had a slight threat. So Stand By Me, of course, a Stephen King novella, The Body, directed by Rob Reiner, who is, I have to say, one of my favourite directors. I love his stuff. And, of course, it had River Phoenix, Jerry O'Connell, who was the fat kid then and then grew and married Mystique, of course.
Rebecca Romijn. Rebecca Romijn.
I'll know her as Mystique. Will Wheaton, of course, now, you know, of Star Trek and Big Bang Theory. And Corey Feldman, who at the time was the biggest star because he had done Goonies.
Yeah.
And it was before he had done Lost Boys. Whether or not they had filmed, you know what I mean? Like something, I know that Lost Boys came out the year later. So he, out of the lot, I think River Phoenix was it Explorers? Or am I going to go with that?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And then of course, it was brilliantly, we had Richard Dreyfuss as the voice, you know, narrating.
Oh, totally. Yeah, and then, of course, Kiefer Sutherland, I mean, as the
bad
boy.
He was the bad boy. Ace Merrill.
And this was just before Lost Boys, which then cemented him, and you know, the only person who could get away with a mullet. Now, it was amazing. And the soundtrack, the 50s soundtrack. I mean, Lollipop, Lollipop, Lollipop. When they're walking down, everything about that film was like sick and balls. I mean, with the dog, sick balls and all, it was beautiful. And it was still tragic because they were going to find a dead body.
Yeah,
that was the whole thing.
It wasn't a happy-go-lucky thing, and no. But it was a perfect stamp in time, and it was just brilliantly done. Great cast. The film that you touched on, I want to talk about real quick, is The Fly. You're a horror expert here. Real quick, I just want to say this movie freaked me out when it came to effects, and it grossed a lot of people out. What's your take on The Fly?
So with The Fly, as much as this is a 1986 film with Blue Velvet, and I think The Fly, it fell into 87 in Australia. And at that time, I was at a TAFE college doing like drama and dance, and we could get a student card, and I upped my age. So instead of being 17, I was 18. So I got to watch The Fly, which was R-rated, which is your X rating. Or whatever it is, like whatever Showgirls was. So X, you had to be 18. Wow. Blue Velvet and Angel Heart.
The R rating would be for us, yeah.
Your R rating's slightly different. It's an X rating, so you have to be that age.
Gotcha.
So David Cronenberg, you know, Canadian, you know, maestro, he was amazing. He'd done the Stephen King film, The Dead Zone, and
it was a Dead Ringers he did as well. I think, yeah, Cronenberg, yeah. That movie here in the States, I know, Jeff Goldblum was great, but man, it really kind of set the bar for like really good practical gross effects, and it was very, very effective. I remember that. Kyle, if you don't mind, I'd like to check with you on Transformers the movie.
You got the touch. But what you say, Kevin? No, Transformers the movie. The movie that traumatized many a young boy in the theaters. Davis Grayson, I know you can agree with me on that.
there was a Transformer movie that year? What?
Yeah. No, yes. Transformers the movie was such a bold undertaking at the time because they paid a lot of money for the Japanese studios to do the animation for that film. It was after the second season of the TV show Transformers. And the big thing with this, I mean, there were so many things with this movie. First and foremost, it was Orson Welles' last performance doing the voice of the creation of Unicron. Now, a lot of people should remember, this movie actually had a massive marketing behind it. There was, at the time, you had USA Cartoon Express, and they were doing like a contest to figure out who the mystery Transformer was in this film, which did turn out to be Unicron. But I mean, you had an amazing voice cast: Judd Nelson of The Breakfast Club fame, Robert Stack, Unsolved Mysteries fame. You had Leonard Nimoy playing Galvatron. Yeah, of course, like I said, Orson Welles' last performance. The thing with this movie, to this day, I'll still say it's one of the more gorgeously animated films for that time frame. But I think the shock everybody had was what, as kids, we did not quite realize this, but it was time to clean up the toy line. They were getting ready to launch the newest wave of Transformers, and they were like, okay, well, you know, we've lost the license to it. In this case, they had lost the license to what was the Japanese toys that the early Transformers were based out of. So to say there was mass death in Transformers, the movie, I think, Davis, would you agree with me? That's an understatement.
I will definitely agree with you. There was actually death that was not even on screen, that we never saw these people again.
Yes. There's a couple of scenes in this film that just popped to mind. The first being when we first experienced Transformer death, when the Decepticons take out the Autobot shuttle, and one of the final scenes in that is Megatron blasting the character of Ironhide, who was immensely popular, basically into about a million little pieces. And I think for most everybody, that shot right there was the one that just everyone was like, whoa, wait a minute. They're dying. because in the cartoon, there's always been, oh, well, they get shot or they get blown up, but they can get put back together. The thing is, about half an hour later into the movie, I think to this day, one of the biggest things to happen in an animated film happened, and that is the death of Optimus Prime. Optimus Prime will
traumatic
go down.
Traumatic for kids, man.
Traumatic. And Optimus Prime will go down to this day as one of the all-time favorite animated characters of all time. You know, he's just that iconic. And when that happened, I mean, there were kids crying in theaters and parents taking their kids out because they were so traumatized. Now, I kind of talked about this a little bit in the last episode of Fandom Flashback, but the big thing about Transformers too, that the effect it had, because so many kids were traumatized about that, later in the year when Hasbro, who also did the G.I. Joe movie, which was more of a syndicated direct-to-DVD release, there was a scene in that where they were planning to kill the character of Duke, who was the leader of G.I. Joe's. Well, now, because of the traumatic effect that Optimus Prime's death had, Duke gets stabbed in the heart by a snake, but instead goes into a coma. And edited in at the end of that movie is, Duke's going to be okay. But
I remember that, yeah.
but I think the biggest thing about Transformers was that, you know, I don't think we had seen anything quite like this on the animated screen. And well, like I said, it was so beautifully done. It just had, at Dragon Con, they just did the 30th anniversary showing in it. So many people came up for it. And I mean, they could just recite it line for line. And
also, too, it had a rocking soundtrack.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. I mean, you had Stan Bush doing a couple of very popular songs to this day in the Touch and Dare. You had Weird Al Yankovic's Dare to Be Stupid on that soundtrack. And you had also had a, he was very big in the 80s. Vince DiCola was a big synthesizer performer in the 80s, and he did several songs for that soundtrack. He also did a couple for Rocky IV as well. So Transformers definitely put in its niche right there in that year. And to this day, it's one of those movies, I think at least once a year, it gets popped into the, whether it's the VCR, the DVD player, or pops up on iTunes, and I will watch it.
That's great. It's classic. And, you know, it was good to talk about that with our, you know, our look back on this film. You know, it's one of those things too, that the toy line is so iconic. And it was one of those things too, with the toy line, I remember that, you know, parents couldn't figure out how to use them, and we could. And I know it's near and dear to all of our hearts here. And so, Kyle, I appreciate you touching on that, because I know how important it is to you. And it's funny, I had forgotten how traumatic that death scene was with Optimus Prime. I mean, that was huge.
Oh, without that, I mean, they even had the, like, the heart monitor device on him going, and then when he passes, his whole body just loses all of its color. Yeah. And I think that was kind of a great play by the animators and the director of the film to actually have that happen, to really hammer home that effect.
Now, before we go on, I want to, we just lost Erin. I'm going to go ahead and give her a call back here.
Okay.
Get her here.
While you're doing that, I do got to give a quick shout out myself to Stand By Me. That is still to one of my all time favorite films. I just have to throw that out there. What a great young cast. And, you know, you see that movie and you just, it makes you so sad for what happened to River Phoenix later in life.
Yeah, he was an upcoming prodigy actor, I would say, is a good way to say. Definitely a big loss. And I still miss him, too, you know, because whenever I see his old films, whether he's, you know, the young Indiana Jones. Definitely. So,
yeah. And one quick note on Flight of the Navigator, too. You can't mention that movie without mentioning Pee Wee Herman himself, Paul Rubens, doing the voice of the alien flying the ship.
That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. It's funny. That was one of the ships, Flight of the Navigator, I didn't catch until much later, but really did enjoy it. So, yeah. We're still trying to get a hold of Erin here. We'll bring her in when we have a chance. One of the films that I wanted to touch on, and I know she liked it as well, was Manhunter.
Oh, yes.
This had a great soundtrack. And it was It was directed by Michael Mann, known famously for also the Miami Vice TV series. And he's gone on to direct other great movies like Heat and a bunch of others. And this also was our first peek at our good friend Hannibal Lecter.
Pre-Anthony Hopkins.
Yes, but William Peterson plays Will Graham. And, of course, he would go on to do the original CSI. And it was just a really great a murder mystery yet kind of thing. But also you really looked into forensics, but then you started getting into the mind of the killers and trying to get into the mind of all of this, why these crimes are happening, and having to talk to Hannibal Lecter. Yet he's kind of obviously a character himself. And this was, he was played by Brian Cox, a young Brian Cox, who's gone on to done certain Marvel films as well. The music was haunting. Aaron, I want to ask you about Manhunter. We had just touched on it, and I know this is near and dear to your heart. Michael Mann, of course, is the director, one of my favorite directors. How did Manhunter affect you?
I think I saw this after Silence of the Lambs. So this would have been a VHS for me. I actually prefer it to Silence of the Lambs. And until the TV show with, of course, Mads Mikkelsen being Hannibal Lecter, I preferred Brian Cox as Hannibal Lecter to Anthony Hopkins, which may ruffle a few feathers.
I do too.
Yeah, it was just a bit, oh, thank you. Yay, there's two of us. Mm-hmm. I just found it a bit more. I mean, look, it was very still Miami Vice, which, of course, I think he produced, didn't he, or directed at the time. It had sort of pastel colours, and I'm a big fan of William Peterson. I thought he was quite hot in it. I liked it. It's not as gothic as Silence of the Lambs. So I actually enjoyed, and I think the scene of Brian Cox as Hannibal Lecter, I find him creepier without being creepy. Does that work out? Yes, because he's not so over this top of, I like it. I think it's a great film. I think it's and it was interesting when they redid it with the Edward Norton Red Dragon, which I didn't like. And again, they redid it in Hannibal with that last season with who gave the Mads Tooth Mikkelsen. Fairy? Mads Mikkelsen, but who was the Tooth Fairy? It's an English actor who was in The Hobbit. He was the main dwarf guy. I can't remember his name. But anyway, it was
Martin
interesting.
Freeman?
No, because he was a hobbit. No, he was a dwarf.
Richard Armitage.
Yes.
Armitage.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so he played the Tooth Fairy in the Hannibal version on TV, which they redid. I think it's great.
I'm in the same camp. I prefer Manhunter over Silence of the Lambs. It's the perfect film when it comes to that type of genre. And it's just that with the music behind it, I love it when he's like looking at the clues and he's looking up at the tree and just how he's scanning everything like that. I had never seen anything like that before. And William Peterson was just great in that film.
Yeah, I think they just pulled it back a little bit more. It was just a bit more understated than all the rest of the films were, so sort of in a sense gothic. And to me, a film more than watching. I felt Manhunter was like watching one of those sort of documentaries that you see, it felt more documentary style than it being this sort of,
No, you're right. It did. It had that feel to it. And it's definitely a good reflection on that time. And it got you behind the scene of look at all these clues and having to do all of this stuff you don't want to do to try and get down to the bottom of stuff, whether it's talking to people like Hannibal Lecter and, how they have their own agenda when they talk to you, and just a great cast. I just want to throw out one of my favorite movies that I discovered later on VHS, a little movie called One Crazy Summer with John Cusack. And here's the reason why I really like this film. And I don't think anyone will argue with me by saying
Better Off Dead was probably one of those classic films, comedy-wise. This is kind of a pseudo-sequel because he did this film after it. Very similar character. Plays Hoops McCann, down on your luck, lost his love, he's an artist.
Well, that's pretty much like all of John Cusack's characters.
Pretty much, yeah. But you could play Better Off Dead and One Crazy Summer back-to-back and pretty much have the same movie.
But with, and this was like Demi... It was Demi Moore before Demi Moore, too.
Yes, yeah. And, of course, it had Curtis Armstrong as Ack-Ack in there as well. And it was a little more, I guess, corny and slapsticky, but it was still that same type of John Cusack humor that we all liked. And just one of my favorites. And in certain ways, I do like it a little bit. There's certain scenes that just stand out for me that I really, really enjoy with that movie.
I love all the animated sequences too.
Yes. Yeah. The killer bunnies that are always making fun of him and stuff like that. So, yeah. Of course, Bobcat Goldthwait was in it. And there's a Godzilla scene in there. I don't know if you remember that, Kyle. Do you remember that?
Oh, it's been so long since I've seen that movie, but yeah, I do. I do remember that.
It had to do with then the cigar get tossed into
the mouth into a costume. Yes,
yeah,
yes, yeah, and he starts crashing on the town, the little miniature town that the evil the guy I think that was in the Twisted Sister videos. He was like the evil developer.
Yeah, Niedermeyer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I thought maybe we could move, unless you guys, if someone wants to jump on something real quick in August here, anyone else want to touch on a movie real quick? Shout out, anything? Okay. Right.
We're going to go on. Real quick, no. I just want to say Armed and Dangerous is a hilarious movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You're love that movie. And real quick, little hit hints about it and everything is Eugene Levy's character. There is actually a lawyer with that same name. I don't know how they got away with it, but that was just one of the cool things. And that movie was actually set up for John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd at one point, if I remember correctly.
Wow. Harold Ramis is one of the writers on there. Director is Mark Lester. Robert Loggia was in that, too. I forgot about that. Yeah. Of course, Meg Ryan, Byron James, one of our favorite character actors. Jonathan Banks. Oh, that's right. I forgot he was in that. Probably well more known now as Anyone Call Saul, and of course Breaking Bad. He was in that as well.
Right.
God, yeah, right. That was a funny movie. Yeah.
Can I just mention?
Yeah.
Just a quick one with Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Yeah.
Sucked. Bad, hated with a fiery passion of being Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Toby Hooper, amazing, great film. Could I say I love it? It's a hard watch, has the most amazing soundtrack as being the most annoying soundtrack because it's just noise, not music. But Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 was the biggest disappointment, and I hated with a fiery passion. So there you go. That was my rant I am having on Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
All right.
Horrible.
Well, September, we're gonna wrap this up with September. September 10th, we had River's Edge. September 12th, we had Blue Velvet. September 13th, we had Avenging Force. September 19th, we had The Men's Club. September 20th, in a limited release, we had Down by Law. September 24th, we had The Name of the Rose. And September 26th, we had Crocodile Dundee, That's Life, and The Boy Who Could Fly. We're going to save Crocodile Dundee till last for special reasons. I want to go to Davis. Any of these jump out at you that you remember?
The only one I remember, and it was not in the theater, but it was on VHS, was The Boy Who Could Fly and Crocodile Dundee, of course. But The Boy Who Could Fly, and it was an interesting, so to speak. It had Fred Savage in it, and one of the cool things it did have is he did have G.I. Joe figures, and he did bury them. I remember that, where after they had died after a mission.
Oh, that's funny. It's funny how certain things in movies will jump out at you, and I love the fact that you're there, our fellow G.I. Joe expert, so that's awesome.
Oh, of course.
Let me see. What about you, Aaron? We'll obviously get into Crocodile Dundee, but is there any of these films on here? I think one of them, you wanted to talk about Name of the Rose.
Well, being the oldest of the crowd, I saw the older film. So River's Edge, I think, actually sort of made Dennis Hopper cool again, because, again, he came out with David Lynch's Blue Velvet for just being insane. So River's Edge and Blue Velvet was a big comeback for him, being sort of, you know, sort of just disappeared for a while. River's Edge is not a first time we probably all saw Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
It was a name. Ione Sky.
Ione Sky.
Yeah, she was in it. Oh, to me, she was like a poor man's Jamie Gertz.
You're not wrong.
Oh, and Crispin Glover in the most insane role. I mean, he's insane. And I think with Back to the Future, he would put, oh, except for Friday the 13th, the final chapter, the fourth one where Corey Feldman killed Jason, he's in that. He was quite pulled back, but nothing will prepare you for the Crispin Glover playing the drug addict sort of leader of the gang. It was a nasty film. It's not a nice film. It's actually quite horrible. But it's, I think, for the most known for Hello, Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, brilliantly acted. Yeah, it was brilliant.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a happy film. You're not going to sit there and go, I loved River's Edge.
Real quick, Norma, you have some thoughts on Ione Sky?
Oh, no, it's like if you can't get Jamie Gertz, you get Ione Sky, right?
That's pretty much, I can't argue with that. That's funny.
Yeah, that's just kind of how it worked out.
Yeah, it was. Blue Velvet, amazing. I think one of the first times we saw Kyle MacLachlan, again, not a happy film. What can you say about Blue Velvet? You know, you got to love David Lynch or you don't. And then, of course, Name of the Rose was the big one, and Crocodile Dundee. But Name of the Rose was just, it was a whodunit in the guise of monks. You know, I mean, who would have thought? I don't think anyone ever finished the book. It's a famous book, and it's one of those films, books that no one ever finishes. I think they start it. It's
like
directed. It's directed by Jean-Jacques Annou, who did the most amazing film called Quest for Fire. If you've never seen it, please go and get it because it's just amazing. It also starred Ron Perlman, who also was in Name of the Rose. Just a side thing, he plays like a hunchback who speaks a pidgin Latin. My mother actually thought he really was a hunchback, so that's how well he played it. Sean Connery, fantastic. A young Christian Slater, 15, one of the best sex scenes ever on film for me. I think it was amazing when he got lost his virginity to the girl in the kitchen. And it was a whodunit. It was an amazing film. Just loved it. It was, I could watch it again. It's one of those films I can watch from start to finish and not get bored at all.
Right.
I think it's great. There you go.
One of the films I wanted to touch on was, this is a total guy flick. It's Avenging Force.
Yes.
Because it introduced us to Michael Dudikoff, a.k.a. the American Ninja.
That's right.
And, and he played a lot of similar characters. Matt Hunter, his former military intelligence man who resigned so he could take care of his sister following his parents' death. You know, Norm, you got a couple thoughts on this?
Well, it's the pairing of Michael Dudikoff and Stephen James.
Thank you, Steve James. Yes.
Yeah. it's like the start of like the bromance action movies.
Totally, because Steve James was also in the American Ninja films.
American Ninja films. That's right.
Yeah, that's. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you brought up Steve James, who unfortunately passed away way too young. But Michael Dudikoff was one of those people that we always look to straight to video releases, and I have to throw that out there because I'm a big fan of his films. They gave me what I wanted, and American Ninja is still one of my. It's funny too. Actually, I enjoyed American Ninja 2 more than I did the second one. So,
well, I mean, you're still in this 1986. This year, you have a lot of military-esque movies. You know, you had Iron Eagle at the beginning, then you had the Delta Force, you had Top Gun, and now you have this. They're kind of
you always have to have some kind of like pseudo military action adventure oriented film in somewhere in the 80s and every year.
Now, before we go into Crocodile Dundee, I want to ask Kyle. Kyle, is there any one of these other films that jump at you real quick?
I think you guys pretty much hit them all. I mean, Blue Velvet, Dennis Hopper and Kyle MacLachlan and David Lynch, always an interesting combination. The Name of the Rose, one of the things I always remember when you guys brought it up was what a great cast in that film. I mean, you go back when it first came out, a lot of people, except outside of Sean Connery, a lot of people like, who? But you look back at it now and you're like, wow. What a cast.
Yeah, totally. Well, the last movie we're going to touch on is, of course, Crocodile Dundee. Huge hit in America. You know, brought us Crocodile Dundee, and to American audiences, we now, and around the world, know who Paul Hogan is. But the reason why we're saving this one best to last is because our good friend here of the show, Miss Erin Gill, has some personal stories. And I, you know what, Erin, I'm just going to open it up to you. Tell us what Crocodile Dundee means to you, and then we'll jump in a little bit later.
Well, Crocodile Dundee, of course, starring Paul Hogan, also starred my late father, Terry Gill, who was an actor in Australia. He passed away a couple of years ago. But he got the role of Duffy. Now, if you're like, who? Basically, he's in two scenes. He's in the scene at the bar at the start when Linda Kwaski turned up and meets Paul Hogan, and they're dancing around, and there's a guy in a big hat with sunglasses, hits Paul Hogan on the leg and says, "You're nothing but a poacher." And, you know, I won't say what Paul Hogan says because it involves something about brains, but he then punches him out, and that was my dad. He also turns up later on when they're in camping in the Kakadu, and suddenly they hear kangaroo shooters driving around drunk, and she says to, you know, Mick Dundee, you know, can you save the kangaroos? And he sort of thinks about it, and suddenly there's my dad looking quite drunk, or as we would say in Australia, pissed. That's, that means drunk in Australian, not angry. And trying to shoot a kangaroo, and the kangaroo actually shoots him. So if you want to check it out, there's a couple of little YouTube little cuts there that I actually put up of my dad. So if you want to see the scenes, they're there. Look under Terry Gill. But yeah, how he got the job. Well, years ago, there was a talent quest called New Faces, and Paul Hogan did a stand-up sort of comedy on it, and my dad was in a musical double called Double Tempo, and they came second. Now, on Wikipedia, it says that Paul Hogan won. Talking to my mother, apparently that wasn't true. Little kid playing the violin won, but never to be heard again. Better was to be said that it was Paul Hogan, but technically they tied, they became some friends. Paul Hogan did the Paul Hogan show. And so when he came to making Crocodile Dundee, he needed someone to play the kangaroo shooter, and he rang my dad. Oh. And dad said, "I'm not going to do it if I have to shoot a kangaroo." And Paul Hogan's like, "Nah, the kangaroo's going to shoot you." And dad's like, "Where do I sign?" So he went to Sydney. Of course, he tried to go, "Why can't I be coming back in America? You know, I could turn up in LA or somewhere." But so he did it, and that was his sort of, not claim to fame, but that was his big part. He had done other films. He punches Dennis Hopper out in Mad Dog Morgan. He was mainly known for TV and Flying Doctors and Prisoner Cell Block H. But, yeah, so they filmed it in 85. It came out in 86. Of course, it was a massive hit around the world. There are actually two versions. There's the Australian version, and, of course, for you American people over there who quite can't get our Aussie accent, we're a bit ocker. I think they sort of took a bit. They took out the larrikin bushman. They changed it up a bit. So I don't think I've actually seen that version. They did with Mad Max, the original one as well. They changed the accents. But, yes, and it was a huge hit. And it was a huge hit in, I think it's still the biggest moneymaker for Australia, like an Australian film. And, of course, it spawned sequels that were never as good. And Paul Hogan never really did anything as good after that. He used to make some great commercials. And if you want to see something amazing, was his little speech at the 1986 Academy Awards. He does a great little sort of intro to something, and it's hysterical. So go onto YouTube because it really is funny. But okay. Yeah, so, you know, it's lovely to see Dad when it comes on TV. And yeah, it's a great film. It's a sweet film. It's you know, it hasn't got a nasty bone in its body for an 80s film. That's slightly rare. But yeah, it was just fun. Everyone got to see how beautiful Australia is. You know, you had the Kakadu Wild Park, and just, you know, it was a fun trip. They fell in love. They got married. They're getting a divorce. They're back together. Who knows? But you know, it's a great film, and it will always be, you know, a big one for me because of, you know, my dad.
Well, let me ask you this, because one of the things that that we can tell, obviously listening to you, is your movie knowledge. And you shared something with me that I thought maybe you could let the listeners know, that movies were a big part of you with your dad growing up. And you talked about doing movie nights and weekends. I was wondering if you could briefly touch on that.
Oh yeah, I think that's how Dad and I communicated. That was our thing. So even, you know, if I was living down the road, he would ring me at work every day to say what he watched last night. I mean, it's how we bonded. I think we were the only two people that went to see Shawshank Redemption at the cinema. You know, I think it bombed so badly before it hit VHS. And I remember Dad ringing me up going, "You've got 5 minutes to get to the Rivoli. We're seeing this movie about a prison." Yeah, okay. All right. Stephen King. Oh, no, I read that, sorry. But I didn't read that one. It was the one you never read. And of course, it was amazing. So, you know, we saw Pulp Fiction together. My dad used to get these magazines called Films and Filming, which was an English films magazine, which was a bit risque. So growing up, I'm looking at, you know, these magazines that had Tinto Brass, Andy Warhol, Paul Morrissey, you know, movies like Flesh for Frankenstein, Blood for Dracula. So my movie knowledge went slightly left of center. So being quite a huge, well, my genre is horror. That's my love and passion. So, yeah, so that's how we communicate. That was, I think, our biggest thing was our love of film. So, yeah, and I still feel him around. I still hear him saying, when I can't remember something, I go like, it's this. Or he'd be in the back going, that's crap. But, yeah, that's good.
Well, on a personal level, I know you've posted some great videos of your dad, and I just want to say thank you for sharing those on Facebook, because you can definitely tell the type of character that he was, and you know, how he loved his family, loved life. And so rest in peace to your father, and it's nice to know that you can look back on these movies and see his see him live on through these and stuff. So I appreciate you sharing.
Well, I mean, that's what we're so lucky about, and that's why I don't feel like he's gone, because of all the stuff we do see of him, like with Crocodile Dundee, or he played Father Christmas at the Carols every year and in Melbourne. So I think that's the what I'm very lucky about, other than people passing and you might just have a couple of photos, is that I still have this sort of living entity around that is always, and you know, and that's how, yeah. So it's good. And last year they played it sort of right near his birthday. That wasn't meant to be, but it just, and you know, and I get people ring, "Oh, I just saw your dad on TV." So,
that's cool.
Yeah, he was definitely, as they would say in Australia, a larrikin.
Well, we wanted to make sure everyone here gets a shot at talking about this film, because it was huge. And I want to start with you, Davis. Did you see it in the theater, and what did it mean to you?
I did not see that in the theater. I saw it later on. I think it was actually on TV, and I enjoyed it. I love the accents, so I thought it was just a great movie. And you know, that was a really cool story that Aaron just shared. So, I mean, I really can't top that.
Well, one of the things that she touched on was the filming locations. And, you know, I saw that in the theater when it came out, and I had always been fascinated about Australia. And my favorite parts of that movie is when they go back to Australia and you get to actually see parts of it there. And, you know, seeing, you know, Crocodile Dundee in his element. And, you know, I'm sure some of it was kind of Americanized for us and such. But it was a peek into Australia, and it you know, that movie got me even more interested about Australia as a country and the politics. And of course, you know, when Midnight Oil came out, you know, got me more interested in Australia and stuff. So that's it's one of those, you know, it's also very quotable. Of course, you know, the big, you know, that's not a knife, you know, that was huge with American audiences here, and seeing him, the fish out of water, here in the United States. And, I guess the best thing for me was that he was always enjoying in the moment, wherever he was, nothing got him down. And people, it's actually a good character study because he was always positive. He always smiled. And wherever he could go, he fit in because he knew how to talk to the crowd. He knew how to get people involved. And that was something that not a lot of people kind of realized at first, but he could make friends. And then when, you know, he would protect his friends, and, you know, and it's just one of the things that I really, really liked about that. Norm, how do you feel about Crocodile Dundee? Where's it stand with you?
Oh, I absolutely love this movie. And I agree with Aaron, that there's all this great positivity in the movie, even though that, you know, 1980s movies are sometimes, you know, they have a lot of the cynicism of the 80s built into it. And I think that's one of the things that I really liked about Crocodile Dundee's character and the way that Paul Hogan portrayed him, is that I think that we used him as like the litmus test of our own cynicism as Americans, because everything that he saw here when he came over here, it was, why are you guys making a big deal over so many small things?
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's what I loved about it. I loved that when he got into the hotel room, he decided to bunk out instead on the floor. When somebody came to mug him, he's like, oh, that's adorable, that night, you know? But that scene really is like the scene that kind of cemented everyone in that memory in 80s pop culture. That's not a knife. This is a knife. You know, that's if there's one scene that people take away from that movie, that's usually it. Or if you're a guy, it's the Linda Kozlowski, I'm going to dip my cantina into the water scene. I don't know why that's memorable.
In the G-string.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, wow, 1986, you're awesome.
You had that. But, I had Name of the Rose.
Yeah, exactly. But that's why I'm going to go back to Jack Britton's character, is that these characters, they just kind of like go through the situation that they're in with just this great kind of, is aplomb the right word? Just this this happy-go-lucky attitude. Whatever happens, happens, and I'll deal with it. And I like that he was never really comfortable. Crocodile Dundee was never really comfortable in our jungle. You see that?
Yeah.
He was, he was in New York City. He was in the concrete jungle. And this jungle, to him, was way more aggressive and dangerous than the actual outback to him.
Yeah.
Because in the outback, out there, everyone, he faced everything with a certain sense of honesty. Like if he had to go hunt something, it's because he needed to. If someone was going to kill him, that animal was going to kill him because it had to. It had none of the agenda and the politics and the backstabbing that our concrete jungle had. So I think he found it just like, it's you can use him as a mirror to take a look at who we were in the 1980s. And in the late 1980s, you started getting into that whole power suit mentality of greed is good, and that happened in the 80s also. So,
and things,
and things,
you know, you needed things,
right?
Yeah, especially during the 80s where, you know, materialism
exists. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Kyle, what about you? What were your thoughts on Crocodile Dundee?
Well, of course, obviously, that's not a knife. This is a knife, like Norman said. That I think is what everybody pulled out of that film. One of the things I remember about Crocodile Dundee, and it was, I think it's something that stands out in the whole year of 1986. We talked earlier in the second episode about how long Top Gun stayed in the theaters. This movie stayed almost just as long in the theaters. If I remember correctly, that movie ran through the theaters into the next year in some cases,
yeah,
because it was that popular. One of my favorite scenes too, I mean, Norman brought up a couple classic ones, is the ending scene where he's walking across people's heads to get to her.
Yeah.
He's just stepping on people. I just get, and then everybody's kind of like then putting on their hard hats and stuff so he can walk across. I just thought that was a great moment. But yeah, I mean, that was the great thing about this movie and about this character was, you know, whatever environment you put him in, he didn't care. He stayed who he was.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what made that movie so refreshing, especially at a time I think when we needed something like that in our theaters. I mean, and the staying power this movie had in the theaters was just amazing. And to this, until this day, I think it's one of those movies that no matter what the time frame is, it's going to be one of those movies you can get into and you can just escape and enjoy it and enjoy the character and enjoy just a basic film.
The one thing I wanted to ask you, Aaron, before we move on is one of the things that a lot of us that were following celebrities was when you had a couple that worked together in a film and they would hook up and maybe get married or, you know, it always made the tabloids. But co-stars Paul Hogan and Linda Kozlowski, they ended up marrying and they stayed together for quite a long time, which surprised a lot of us. But we always love successful love stories, especially when, you know, it's so common for these power couples to divorce after a short time. These guys tend to we found it fascinating that they stayed together for a while. I wonder if you could kind of touch on that, because I think they eventually got a divorce. But give us a little background on that and how that was, how that was seen with, you know, the pop culture in Australia.
Well, he originally, so he was working on the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Do you know the iconic Sydney Harbour Bridge?
Yes.
You've got the Opera House, but then they've got this huge bridge. So that's what he would do. And basically when they did the new faces, they would, you know, you'd have the, like with, you know, American Idol or any X Factor, you'd always have these judges that would probably, you know, they'd be the nasty one. And so that's how he got to do the new faces, was to do an act where he gave crap to the judges. And so he wasn't an actor or anything. He was just this guy who had a good sense of humor. And he was married and he had five children. So he's got, so he was married quite young. I think he was married like 18 to Nolene, and he's got like, you know, five kids. Then came along, you know, making the movie, and he was in his late 30s, I'm going to go with. Maybe even 40s, could have been 42. I know that it was before they were making the film that everyone knew that they were having an affair. And she was 26, so she's a lot younger.
Gotcha.
So she was 26 when she did the movie, and Dad knew. Dad said, no, they're having an affair, and everyone knew. And basically I think once the movie came out, he got a divorce. But he was with it. It wasn't like, yeah, it was just, you know, well, I mean, as Norm said, you saw it in the, you know, the little G-string, one-piece black lycra, you know, going into the water, and then the crocodile jumps up. And that was it. And then they were together for a long time. I don't think she made that dreadful John Carpenter Village of the Damned. I think one of the last things Christopher Reeves did before he had the accident.
Mm-hmm.
And then other than that, I think she stayed home and looked after the child. They have one child who I think's gone off the rails, according to a Woman's Day in the thing at the moment, I walk past. So,
but they stayed married for a while, didn't they?
They did. They did a good like 20-odd years, I think. And then I think they split up, but now they've sort of apparently come back together because of their son. But other than that, he had a lot of drama about tax. He had a big issue where I don't think he played enough tax. But then again, think of it this way. He was the ambassador for Australia, where he made ads about for you guys to come over and throw a shrimp on the barbie and check out, you can meet kangaroos and do all that, which you can. I went for a walk the other day, walked through kangaroos, only just half an hour, you know, away from where I live. So it was that to bring you guys over. And really Crocodile Dundee was an extension of these ads that he did for Tourism Australia. So he always turned around and said, I may not have paid a lot of tax, but I made you guys a ton of money.
Yeah.
In a sense of all the tourism that came over to Australia because of the ads that I did. So that was just a little bit of, you know, controversial trivia with Paul Hogan. And he moved to America. He did like a Sean Connery and left, never came back. Sean Connery did the same. I think he moved to Spain. Yeah, I'm not paying tax in London. And Paul Hogan did the same. He moved to LA, and he was to LA for a long, long time. Gotcha. Don't know if he still is there. So yeah.
Well, Aaron,
I'm sorry. Go ahead. But Paul Hogan fared probably a lot better than the first Australian actor that we saw this year, Brian Brown, because he was in FX earlier this year. And I loved FX.
Yeah.
But
yeah, big fans of
that. It didn't have the same staying power that Crocodile Dundee had.
Well, Aaron, I want to thank you very much for sharing your personal story and growing up with your father, Terry, and sharing your personal stories on that. It's for us, I feel honored that you did that. So thank you very much.
That's fine. Thank you.
Well, as we wrap this up, guys, I want to mention for the top 10 box office films, Crocodile Dundee. And like you said, Kyle, it stayed in the theater for a long time, like Top Gun did. Crocodile Dundee came in at $174 million, just under the number one spot, Top Gun, which had $176 million. So it stuck around for a while. The other film that we talked about in this part three came in at number seven, and that was Aliens with $86 million. So obviously these films in this section was just, you know, it was the middle of the summer going into the fall. And it's amazing that Crocodile Dundee came in number two, but coming in later in the year at the end of September. So as you said, Kyle, it stuck around for quite a long time. One of the things I want to mention too is that, well, let me first of all say, Aaron, thank you so much for coming on. We really, really appreciate you, giving us your insight and, the pop culture that was going on as well. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on us Americans should know about what was happening at that time in Australia?
Oh, in current affairs wise, I mean, we had a very big, there was a case where Lindy Chamberlain and her family were camping in the Northern Territory. And one night she woke up and her little baby Azaria had gone, and she'd seen a dingo run out of the tent. And that was a massive case where it was the whole a dingo took my baby, or it eventually sort of changed into a dingo ate my baby. And that became a huge thing where she actually went to jail. Because no one believed her that a dingo would come in and snatch a child. Of course, later on they actually found a matinee jacket, and she got the case got sort of dismissed. She was taken out of jail. She did serve for a while. In 1986, she was released from prison in Darwin. And that case inspired the film Cry in the Dark with Meryl Streep. We knew it as Evil Angels. And I think she was up for the Academy Award for that. She did quite a good accent because she had quite a broad accent, and it was always that catchphrase of, a dingo ate my baby. of course, it then became quite famous in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, as Kyle would know, as whose band?
You caught me off guard here.
Oz's
Someone's
band.
Oz's band. Yeah. Was, yeah, yeah.
I just can't. So, I can't think of the name of it.
Dingo Ate My Baby. It was Oz's.
It was Oz's band.
Dingo Ate My Baby.
Yeah, Seth Green, is that his name?
Green.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah,
that was 1988. Meryl Streep came out with that, right?
Yes. So 1986, she was released from the jail after being in jail for for about 5 years. Also, we had a lot of bushfires. Now, I think – I don't know if you guys get it. I know that Normwood – I don't know where you are in L.A., but I know you guys get quite a few bushfires in L.A., don't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm south of L.A., but that's – we're just pretty much – if you're not in the city, you're desert.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's just bushfires can pop up anywhere.
Yeah, so that's our big – we don't get a lot. We get occasional tornadoes – or not tornadoes. We get occasional cyclones up north. But our big thing is bushfires, and that was a big year for it. We also had a Russell Street bombing where these guys blew up a police station. One woman died. It inspired the great film Animal Kingdom that came out a few years ago. The Americans, you guys decided to make it into a TV show. Slightly changed it up, but that was a great movie with Guy Pearce. During that time, Neighbours started, one of our longest-running soap dramas. Kylie Minogue came from Neighbours, and, of course, Guy Pearce was Mike
in Neighbours. So, yeah, Dire Straits made history in Tasmania with having, like, the biggest audience over an open-air concert, but it was Tasmania, so that's not saying a lot, but there you go. Nice. So that's sort of what was happening in Australia. It was mainly the Lindy Chamberlain. I think if you guys had all the other stuff, ours was the Lindy Chamberlain. That was the really big one after everybody literally wanted her to be hung.
Wow.
For killing that, they realized that maybe she didn't do it. And a dingo did eat her baby.
Wow. Fascinating. Yeah. It's unfortunate but interesting how the dingo ate my baby has now become, you know, like a catchphrase like that. So wow. Mm. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your personal stories. We really appreciate that. Davis, thank you for coming in as well. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, sir. I do appreciate it.
Yeah. I want to mention real quick, we'll get to the contact information, but I want to let people know about what's happening on the Fandom Podcast Network. And since we have Aaron here, we want to let people know that Lakeland, Florida, LashCon events for our Highlander 30th anniversary event, that Aaron will be there as well as with me.
Yay!
And Kyle and Davis will be there as well, representing Blood of Kings.
Aaron, it's not too late to run yet.
if I can sit through, you know, like 15 hours of a Highlander sleeve, I'll be fine. I'm all right. I can go through pain.
Well, if anyone's interested in the event, it's going to be at the Lakeland Convention Center, Lakeland, Florida, and go to lashconevents.com and then click on the Highlander link. A Culture Clash, we have a regular show. That's our weekly show I co-host with my buddy Kyle here, talking about the latest fandom news. And we recently just had Mr. Norman Lau on there briefly. Well, not briefly, but we kind of went into a couple things.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping we'd have Lopan more.
So yeah, we had Norman on there. We brought him over from Blood of Kings. And speaking of Blood of Kings, Norman and I just recorded an episode last night, and we had the Kingmaker edition with Anthony DeLongis. And the newest episode that just came out now is the Men of Steel, the Weapons of Highlander, the original 1986 film. And Norm and I just also recorded something. Norm, you want to let us know about that?
Yeah, in about a week's time when it drops on episode 18, we have the Broken Boken, where we recount my tales of the sword experience that I was able to just enjoy thoroughly last October 29th. And it's a mega-sized show because we had some mega-sized memories that I wanted to share, and we're excited to bring that to all the listeners to Blood of Kings.
Yes, yeah, we're really excited about that, and I learned a lot interviewing you, and I think Aaron is going to be participating in that as well Highlander.
Oh, yeah?
So it will be interesting. It will be interesting on the who. No, it will be fun. It will be a lot of fun.
So that episode will be homework for both.
You know what? I almost don't want you guys to listen to that one because I want you to go in and have your own thing, you know? So.
No. We'll do the homework.
Okay.
Right. One thing I did want to mention for those of you listening that may be going to the Highlander 30th anniversary, we will be having a Blood of Kings meetup the night before. We're going to be meeting at the Chili's Grill and Bar down the street from the convention center. So for more information, stay tuned for that. You can find there probably will be. The other show I got to mention, Couch Potato Theater. We have both Davis and Norman here. You guys did a great job with looking back. We did the retrospective, Kyle and I, with you, but you guys did a great audio commentary for The Last Starfighter, and it's become one of our most popular Couch Potato Theaters. And Davis, I just want to say thank you for helming that. You did an awesome job, and we're looking forward to what's coming up next. And I know you've got a lot of stuff to think about, and we'll be narrowing that down shortly. But thank you guys for doing that. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the kind words.
Well, I have the best gunner in the galaxy right there.
And it was such a pleasure to be with Norm talking about it. It was a lot of fun.
Was a lot of fun. Thank you.
You can find all of these shows on the Fandom Podcast Network on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and Google Play. Facebook, you can find the Fandom Podcast Network. We also have a group there as well, so please join that. Email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. We want to get more emails, hear what you guys got to say, and we'll read them on the air as well. Instagram, Fandom Podcast Network, and you can also find Blood of Kings there as well on Blood of Kings Pod. On Twitter, Fandom Pod, Fan Pod Network. And Kyle, where can we find you on Twitter?
You can find me at AKyleW, the shortest Twitter handle out there, but hey.
Norman, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Starfighter1701.
Davis, where can we find you on Twitter?
You can find me on Twitter at Davis Grayson.
I'm Kevin. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Spartan_Phoenix. Now, our other special guest here, Aaron, I know you're not on Twitter, but you are on Instagram, yeah. on Facebook. Let the listeners know how they can reach out to you.
Well, I'm on Instagram under Audrey Worm and on Facebook under Aaron Gill. Look under Melbourne, Australia. Awesome. There's usually a picture of me and Clancy Brown. So there you go.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And for those of you listening to this for the first time, if you get a chance, go check out our early episodes of Blood of Kings. I think it was episode 9 where we interviewed you about your experience with meeting Clancy Brown and doing the Highlander 4K premiere event where you got to meet him and also do your own Highlander adventure. So please go back and check that episode. It was a great interview and a great insight to a wonderful time you had there. So many
bucket lists.
Yeah.
Ticked off. So many. They were falling on me. Tick, 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 tick. That's good.
I'd like to thank my co-host, Aaron Davis, and Kyle and Norm. Thank you for coming in. I really appreciate you. Thank you. It was really good to have you on. And Davis, thanks again for coming on. I want to let people know, too, Davis is going to be on the part 4, the final episode of the Fandom Flashback on October, November, December, going to cover, because you're going to talk about toys, your specialty there. You want to give a quick little shout out to what you might be touching on?
Of course. 1986, that was a great year for toys because not only did it have a real American hero that I mentioned earlier, but it also had the release of the Nintendo and a few other things. But this is where I would say this is pretty much where 1986 is where the video game generation actually started.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing that part and look forward to having you on there. Thank you all for joining me on the special presentation of the Fandom Flashback, Part 3 of 1986. Join us next time for Part 4, Fandom Flashback, for the months of October, November, and December. We will cover movies such as The Color Money, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, Three Amigos, Platoon, and Heartbreak Ridge. Real quick, Aaron, any one of these jump out at you?
Oh, Platoon. It was just soundtrack, scene with Willem Dafoe and the Adagio of Strings, Tom Berenger and Willem Dafoe, just beyond, I think, still one of the best of the war films, and I'm not a great fan. It is something to watch. It's an amazing anti-war film. Amazing. There you go.
Norm, what about you? Which one of these jumps out at you? I could probably take a guess.
Take a wild guess.
Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
Mm-hmm. Heartbreak Ridge.
Yep. It should have been Heartbreak Bridge. You are wrong. No, I'm just kidding.
I sit corrected.
No, I'm sorry. You're right. It's Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Everyone knows. Most of the people on the Fandom Podcast Network know I'm a huge Trekkie.
Yeah. What about you, Kyle? Was it Heartbreak Ridge?
No, it was a Heartbreak Ridge. I'm right there with Norm. Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. I mean, to me, still maybe one of the best films of the original Trek cast outside of Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, I would agree. That was also probably the most successful, also known as the Whales film, but just a great travel back in time movie and seeing them in you know, hanging out. In 1986, it was a great film. But the one that really stands out to me is Heartbreak Ridge. I think probably, I'm gonna go out on a ledge and say that possibly my favorite Clint Eastwood film for so many reasons. I saw it with my dad too, And, you know, my dad and I bonded over this film, and, I loved the grunt gunny character that he played, and, you know, getting this misfit of soldiers together and working with them and getting my, and there's that scene at the end where you see Mario Van Peebles actually call for help by using his credit card there in Grenada, you know, and then, he uses certain ways to train these guys and lets him know that an AK-47 makes distinctive sound. So,
hey, I got to give a quick shout out to the Golden Child, which came out in December of 86.
Yeah, it was also huge. It was in the top 10 moneymaker as well. So,
can I also just say thank you for letting me come on the show? It's been an absolute pleasure. I loved the last two shows. So, listeners, if you happen to just catch this one, go back. It's been an absolute thrill reliving all these great, great, great films. And I think it was a great time. I still love, think 80s films are my favorite. Same with 80s music. Maybe it's just the time that we sort of were growing up, being impressionable. But also 87, I feel that there's stuff in there, so much stuff in there. So I'm not hinting at all, boys, not hinting at all. But 80s, could I say Lost Boys? Could I say Near Dark? Could I say Angel Heart? It just was, oh, my God. So if you feel like that this could be maybe another, a part two, a sequel to 1986 will be 1987, I'm going to put it out there.
I like that suggestion. We'll have to do that and get you back on, because there was some good movies in 87. I'm glad you touched on that. And I want to say you gave us, I think, the ultimate or you gave me the ultimate compliment on the last two, where you're listening to it and you're like, oh, I so wanted to join in on that conversation. And we Norm and I had heard similar praise when we on some of our feedback we got on Bloody King. So thank you very much.
I don't know if you asked this question at the beginning, Kevin, because I was possessed by David Lopan, but so I don't remember that part. Yeah. So, Aaron, you're obviously a student and someone who loved the 80s. That was your wheelhouse, and you grew up in it, and it's really a part of your fiber. So the reason why we did 1986 is because we wanted to make the case that 1986 is the best year of movies in the decade of the 80s.
Do you agree?
You don't have to answer that now. I just wanted to ask
you
that.
No, wait. I want her to answer.
It's hard. For me, okay. Two of my favorite years on a whole of as a across the board and looking at 87. I can't say one or the other. Because I actually find that there's 87 for me, for my genre of films. I mean, Angel Heart to me is still in my top 10 films of all time. The Hidden with Michael Neary and Kyle MacLachlan, one of the best buddy cop films ever.
I still need to see it.
Ever. It's and just amazing. So there's for me personally, for across the board as a commercial thing, maybe 86. But for me personally, it's a hard one, because there were so many good ones that for me for 87. So yeah, there you go. Okay. Just to put a spanner in the works and a fly in the ointment.
That's good.
Norm, do you stand on 86 as being the best?
I think that actually Aaron brought up a really good point. I think that 86 commercially is the best. Yeah. Commercially. Because you're dealing with some properties now that are they still have withstood the test of time. Say like Top Gun, yeah. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, yeah. Aliens, yeah.
But so do you think it's the best year in film? Putting you on the spot.
The best year in film?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's the best year in film overall. I mean, we're talking about, I don't know, since film began, but I do think it's the best year in the 80s block of films. Okay. Because again, you're talking about things that aren't just nostalgic to us, but things that have really, like, they have changed kind of the lexicon of pop culture, especially something like Ferris. Ferris has lasted the test of time, and that boom, boom, you know, that whole, that, you know, everything that he did in that movie is still legendary now, you know, so that means something. It means that they got it right the first time, a lot of it, and Aliens too. Yeah. So there's just a lot of what happened in 1986 that still continues to this day. overall, like consecutively, almost month for month.
Gotcha. Well, hey, Davis, what about you? Do you think this is the best year in movies, in the, at least in the 80s?
If it's not the best, it's one of the closest to the being the best because, you know, 86, it released Aliens. 87 gave us Predator. So,
oh, God, yeah.
I mean, I think Aaron has a good idea for releasing a sequel to this, doing 87 movies, because think about it. Not only do we have Predator, but there's Dirty Dancing, The Princess Bride.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mannequin.
Lost Boys.
Lost Boys. Empire of the Sun. Moonstruck.
Angel Heart.
The Running Man. And one of my personal favorites, Masters of the Universe.
Stop conflicting me! Oh, my God!
And good morning, Vietnam!
Wait.
Kyle, I want you to chime in here.
I'm going to cheat.
Wow.
I'm going to call 1986 to 1987 the greatest two-year block in movie history.
Boom.
I can dig it.
Well, again, guys, thank you so much. And I just want to say this trip down memory lane has really ignited a fire in me to catch up on some of these movies I have not seen.
Oh, damn it. 87 has Spaceballs.
Oh, yeah, told you.
Isn't there a shot for that?
It was like 86 wet the palate. 86 wet the palate. And then it was like, okay, I'm ready to face what's coming.
That is a tough lineup right there, I gotta admit.
I shudder to think if we did a trilogy, what does 88 bring for us?
Oh no, I think it starts going off the boil.
You might have to go back to about 84, 82.
85, sure thing.
83 is a good year too.
Favorite comedy of all time.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, guys, man, we could just go on and on and talk about this, but that's why we have this. That's why we have the Fandom Flashback to do this, and we have one more to go. But I want to thank you guys for coming on, I shared with you guys, a couple of you guys, that my love for doing this podcast, and it's gotten me to connect with movies that I haven't seen in a long time and movies I have not seen, and I picked up thanks to you, Norm. Because of our interview with Anthony DeLongis, I have on Laserdisc Sword and Sorcery.
Get on so that cool. film.
So good. The greatest. Right?
Yes. Right? So I'm really looking forward to popping that in and playing it. I just got it. So, and it came all the way from Korea. So, it's one of those you can't find it anywhere. It's, you know, there's a lot of these, and that's another show about movies that, you know, you can't find anymore because they didn't make the jump from VHS to DVD. But anyway, I just want to say thank you guys all for coming onto this show. Really appreciate it. I know this one's running a little bit long, but we had to, because this is, the best 3 months of this year. Some of the biggest movies as well. So until next time, my name is Kevin and I'll see you in 1986. Goodbye.
Express elevator to hell. Going down.
How long after we're declared overdue can we expect a rescue?
17 days.
17 days? Hey, man, I don't want to rain on your parade. We're not going to last 17 hours.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.